Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Oh, so much to get to. What a day. Not just here in Pennsylvania, but across the country. Let's start in Philadelphia. Our governor went to Philadelphia. Going to go to one of his charter schools and, you know, do the whole, I love charter schools. I think it was all about, hey, we're going to start talking about increasing funding for education. Then he bails. He bails. And, you know, at first, I'm outraged. I'm going, how could you do that to the kids? And they go, what am I talking about? This guy doesn't care about kids. He's got $1 billion each of the last 3 years from public education. Not a thought went through his head about, oh, the children. Oh, I care about the children. And I love the lame excuse he gives. Well, I didn't want it to be political. Why? Because there were people there who were going to say, not happy with your policies. Don't like it. So, you know, tail between the legs and running for the hills, or at least to his office there in Philadelphia. Also going to talk about the education Texas style, you know, because, hey, Pennsylvania could be the Texas of the Northeast. And we, too, can not teach about evolution or rational thought or really anything that has anything to do with fact. Just, I believe. Yes. Also going to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, or more specifically, Fast Track Authority, which blows my mind that anybody would consider giving any president Fast Track Authority. I don't care, Democrat, Republican, Socialist, Communist, Anarchist, I don't care. No Fast Track Authority for anybody. Stop it. Also going to talk about the war on workers as the Republicans here in Pennsylvania gear up for, you know, it's their turn. And, you know, look, when you look at our legislators here in Pennsylvania, now they get to be in the spotlight. Now they get the shining light of the Wall Street money of the billionaire class is going to shower down on them. Because as we've been saying, the word that I'm getting is the Koch brothers were in town saying that they will double any money that workers give to Republican candidates, they'll double it. Double it. Because they want this paycheck deception. They want this paycheck destruction. They want it. And they want it so that they can silence people. And they have created an amazing network in this state of propagandists. And we will talk about some of that tonight. Also, your thoughts, questions, comments, whatever's on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. You can also email me during the program, Rick@therickSmithShow.com, or Facebook, Twitter, all that stuff. Now, the big news of the day. Something, you know, I've been saying for a couple years now is going to happen. Prepare for it. The voter suppression law, the one that Mike Terzai said, voter ID, done, going to allow Mitt Romney to win the presidency. Unconstitutional. Unconstitutional. And we knew this. We honestly knew this from the beginning. Because this wasn't about protecting the ballot. What nonsense is that? This wasn't about protecting your right to vote. This was about stealing people's rights to vote. And a lot of folks are okay with it because it's those people. You know, them over there. Without thinking that, you know, eventually, you know, you go back to Pastor Niemöller's famous poem. You know, first they came for the communists, and I said nothing. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I said nothing. And by the time they got to me, there's nobody left to say anything. And, you know, you think of these attacks. You know, Obama's a socialist and a communist going after them. Because, you know, he's not. I mean, anybody who would accuse this guy of being a socialist, even a socialist, needs to get a dictionary. Maybe just look it up once. Just a thought. And now they're going after the union workers. They're going after people's right to organize. And what's next? How much further down the corporatocracy road do we have to go? How much further down, and I will say the F word, how much closer to fascism do we have to become before we wake up and go, ah, corporate America doesn't care about this country. They care about their bottom line. That's it. But today's decision, and the right decision. The judge said requiring electors who lack compliant photo ID to get a driver's license, to get to a driver's license center that may not be in their county and may be several miles away and unreachable by public transport is untenable. Now, you know, we've talked about, we've covered this issue top to bottom, front to back from day one. And it goes back to my original, and you know, this is, you know, goes back to the Knights of Labor, back in the late 1800s. An injury to one is a concern of all, which eventually morphed into an injury to one is an injury to all. If even just one person was denied their right to that ballot box, it should be ruled unconstitutional. And they showed a number of people. They came up with numbers saying, you know, tens of thousands of people were disenfranchised by this. But even if it was just one, that's one too many. And I think of that 95-year-old woman, Vivette Applewhite, who, you know, I got to be honest, you got to give her credit. She's voted in just about every election going back to the days of, you know, Truman. And to say that she can't vote? Ludicrous. Now, the right decision. Now, it's going to go on, understand, it's going to go on to the Supreme Court. And my concern is that we have packed the Supreme Court with good corporatists and good. I shouldn't even say conservatives, because I don't believe the people who are running our government right now, either the state or federal level, are actually conservative. I believe they're extremists. I believe they're corporatists. I believe there are some conservatives. You know, I think of, you know, some of the folks that have come out, the guy in California who said, you know, why are we subsidizing a low-wage workforce? Conservatism is about pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, making a good living, and supporting your family. Why are we subsidizing bad employers? That sounds fairly conservative. That sounds like understanding the institution and preserving it. But I look at this decision, and there's a lot of this yet to come, in the right direction. Now, the thing I think we should all be frustrated and angry about, and you go back to when the trial was going on, and we covered the trial extensively. The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and I keep the stipulation of fact on my desk, because it shows me how people who don't believe in government run it into the ground and run it poorly, and why we should not be voting for people who say, I don't believe in government, or I want to strangle it, or I want to restrain it. Or, you know, like Grover Norquist says, I want to drag it in the bathtub and drown it. The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania agreed in the stipulation of fact. And before any of these trials happen, both sides agree to certain, they come to the common ground. Say, this isn't what we're arguing about. The reality is, These are the facts we both agree to. Both sides agreed in the stipulation of fact that there has never been a case where this law that was passed by Republicans only here in the Commonwealth, while this law would have never stopped anything. There's never been a case where this law would have stopped anything. There is not a case being investigated. There is nothing that this would do to secure the vote. So if that's the case, and start with me from that premise, the premise that there's never been a case of voter fraud that this would have stopped, there's never been a case that they've prosecuted, investigated, nothing. There's nothing. They agree we've never found anything. This law would stop nothing because it doesn't exist. If that's the case, if you agree to that from the start, right from the get-go, if you agree that's the reality, why pass the law? Why waste taxpayer dollars? Why spend millions of dollars litigating, advertising? Why spend all of this time, energy on a law that's going to, according to the stipulation of fact, stop nothing? Prevent no voter fraud. Because it doesn't exist. It's not there. Why would you do it? And the only rational thought you can come to, the only common sense position one could possibly achieve would be it's about suppression. It's about Governor Corbett while candidate Corbett saying, you know, if we can hold the vote down in Philadelphia, we'll win. It's about Chairman Gleason, the Republican Party chairman in Pennsylvania, saying that, well, you know, Obama beat McCain by 10 points, but only beat Romney by 5. Voter suppression had, oops, something to do with it. Had everything to do with it. And they wanted this so bad. He wanted to say it. So bad. Like Mike Terzai, voter ID, done. Why was voter ID done? So we could make Mitt Romney win. I don't think that's a far stretch. I don't think it's a huge leap. I don't think it's a Herculean leap to come to the common sense position that our Republican leadership, the people that we spend time investing in, paying their salaries so that they will do our work. I don't think it's too much to ask that they not take us on these fool's errands. And not spend millions of dollars when we're broke. Because understand, now look, if we were flush in cash and there was money everywhere and all the roads were smooth as glass and every school had, you know, 15 to 17 kids in every class with a highly paid teacher with all the books and technology and every bright, shiny buildings and everything was wonderful. We had high-speed rail and public transportation and everything was just humming along and we're going, we just got all this cash. We don't know what to do with it. We're just swimming in it. Then I say, ah, what the heck. Let's have this little misadventure where we can bicker and go back and forth. But the reality is they keep telling us we're broke and we've got to take money from education. We've got to take money from health and human services. And we've got to let our infrastructure crumble. And we've got to make sure our kids sit in bigger classrooms. In buildings that when it snows, those classrooms fill up with snow. We got to do that so we can argue about a piece of legislation that stops nothing. Explain that to me. Can anyone defend that? Can anyone make a cogent argument about why this was a good idea, why this was a judicious use of our taxpayer money, of our time and our energy? Can anybody make a cogent argument about the last election cycle where the Corbett administration spent $1 million saying, oh, voter ID is coming, so you better go get your voter ID because it's coming and you better do it? The reality is no. No one can make that argument, especially when I hold this piece of paper in my hand that says we've never found it. We've never found a case of voter fraud that this law would have stopped. Yet they've wasted our time, our energy, our money, and time that they could have been putting into a visionary path towards making this the best state in the Commonwealth. But instead, they took the Koch brother playbook, they took the big moneyed interest, the Wall Street playbook, and they're just following the marching orders. And marching orders not coming from you and me and the rest of us, but coming from Wall Street and the corporate boardrooms. That is my problem. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I'll talk a little bit more about the voter suppression law with one of the attorneys involved in the case. Right back. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The National Labor Relations Board complained against Walmart this week as the board's largest ever complaint against an employer. It alleges that Walmart illegally fired and disciplined workers for using their legal rights to speak out for better jobs in 14 states at 34 stores. The NLRB says Walmart broke federal labor law, violating workers' rights by retaliating against them for job actions, strikes, and protests aimed at improving their jobs. 63 store managers are named, as well as a Walmart spokesman and vice president of communications, accused of being responsible for illegal threats against workers. Barbara Collins was fired by the company. She says Walmart workers have a right to speak out and won't be silenced. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers had very different Walmart news. On Thursday, they announced an agreement with Walmart to join the Fair Food Program to benefit farm workers. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers said Walmart agreed to work with the workers' organization and Walmart's Florida tomato suppliers to strengthen and expand the Fair Food Program. The program gets companies to pay a small increase in the price they pay for tomatoes to concretely and directly benefit farm workers. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers is working to improve working conditions and pay in the fields and says it's pleased to welcome Walmart into the Fair Food Program. Michigan's appeals court this week upheld the 2012 law that cut pensions for public school employees by requiring them to put more of their wages into the pension system. Michigan's American Federation of Teachers had challenged the constitutionality of the law. The law imposed what amounts to a $15 billion pensions cut on the public school workers. Despite that huge hit on their pensions, the court ruled it did not violate Michigan's constitutional ban on diminishing public worker pensions. The court said it didn't diminish current vested pension benefits, just future benefits. That same law eliminated employer-provided health care for new hires in Michigan public schools. 30 workers at a Delaware Amazon warehouse voted against joining the International Association of Machinists. That vote was 21-6 against union representation. The IAM said Amazon worked behind the scenes to turn workers against the union. The union said workers faced intense pressures from managers and anti-union consultants hired to suppress the organizing drive. But IAM Eastern District spokesman John Carr says the IAM won't give up on organizing Amazon workers. Unions in Los Angeles are promoting a $15 minimum wage. The Los Angeles City Council is expected to introduce a minimum wage ordinance soon. Unions in L.A. released a report this week from the Economic Roundtable that says more than 810,000 residents of Los Angeles make less than $15 an hour. The unions have put up city limits billboards downtown on the city's west side and near the airport. They say, Los Angeles, city limited. Poverty wage population, 810,864. The Economic Roundtable report says that 46% of workers in Los Angeles make less than $15 an hour, and a citywide raise to $15 would be enough economic stimulus to create 67,400 new jobs in Los Angeles County.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
Done. Yeah, it's done all right. You know, I think who's done? I think the governor's done. How many strikes do you get when you play the game? There's unconstitutional Act 13, unconstitutional the gerrymandering first time around, unconstitutional this voter suppression law. How many bites at the apple do you get before you go, you're just wasting our tax dollars? Maybe if you had to spend that time and that energy at improving our infrastructure, at improving education, maybe a second term. But I got to tell you, this has got to be the nail in the coffin. But I think this is the right decision. Now, I believe it will be appealed. But for right now, this is the right decision, which is why we've asked Marianne Snyder. She's a senior attorney at the Advancement Project, advancementproject.org, the website. Marianne, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Today, anyway, a good day, I guess, right?
Yes, great day for Pennsylvania voters and democracy.
You know, earlier on I talked about the one thing that just completely frustrates me. We followed this whole trial all the way through, and right from the very start, the Commonwealth stipulated in the stipulation of fact that there's never been a case that this would have stopped. They can't find anything. There's nothing being prosecuted. They know of nothing. But why do you then go and pursue this if it would stop nothing?
Well, I think that's a good question. That is what the legislature said they were doing. They were trying to prevent voter fraud, but not only did they stipulate, but we had an expert who said that the only kind of voter fraud this kind of law would prevent is in-person impersonation, and that kind of voter fraud is exceedingly rare. And the decision today credited that testimony and said that's not enough. Just having the fear that there might be voter fraud isn't enough to burden a constitutional right.
One of the things I thought interesting is he said the Department of State's the ID that they were going to hand out is, in his words, fraught with illegalities and dubious authority. I thought that was an interesting way of putting it, especially when you look at the different places where people would have to go or couldn't go to get them. It's an interesting statement.
Well, that is an interesting statement. What he basically was saying there is that the Department of State didn't have the authority under the voter ID law to substitute this Department of State ID for the one that was enacted. So in other words, the statute said PennDOT non-driver ID is going to be the ID that people are going to get, and it has to be free of charge. But the way they were implementing that, the Supreme Court already said that's got to be, it has to comport with liberal access. And so because people couldn't get that one, they started implementing this Department of State ID. And the court said, well, you didn't have authority under the statute to substitute the Department of State ID for the PennDOT ID. And by the way, the way you were implementing it wasn't consistent with the notion of liberal access. So that's what he was saying, that they didn't have the authority under the statute to say this is going to be the ID now.
Okay, you know, because you know, I go through this and I go back to the question, you know, if there's nothing that this would have stopped, and you pursued it anyway, what about the fraud that is actually happening? Was there no time spent going after, you know, the people who say, well, Election Day has been moved until next week, and send out flyers that your polling place has been moved, or robocall, all those things? It seemed to me a misplaced priority. And well, I guess it comes back down to, in my opinion of it, is that it was just to do what Governor Corbett said when he was candidate Corbett in 2010, we need to hold the vote down in Philadelphia.
Well, I think that what we've seen is that the effect of these laws is to suppress the vote, and there actually have been some studies recently that show where African American or Latino voter turnout increased in recent years, and the legislature is controlled by one political party political party that controls Pennsylvania, for example, were more likely to see these kinds of laws enacted. So it seems to me that because it makes it so much harder for hundreds of thousands of Pennsylvanians to vote, that the notion of ID wasn't really behind this law. I mean, we already had an ID law in the book for first-time voters.
Correct.
And much broader, including non-photo ID, and was apparently doing its job because there were no prosecutions, and there was no knowledge of any prosecutions for in-person voter fraud.
Yeah, you know, but I go back to, you know, very simply that, you know, this injury to one is an injury to all. Even if it was just one person who was disenfranchised, one person that was turned away, I think this law should have been ruled unconstitutional and moved along. So in going back to his decision, give me the short version. It's a 103-page decision, which to me it seems very simple, and in layman's terms, it's to me very simple. But 103 pages of verbiage seems a bit excessive.
Well, it's actually the opinion itself is 50 pages, and then the rest of it is he had to make findings of fact because we didn't have a jury in this case. He was the fact finder, so the opinion itself is only 50 pages. But remember, we had three trials in this case, so he had to review, and he wasn't the trial judge in two of them. He was only the trial judge in the third trial. So he had a huge record to review, lots of testimony, and he did, I think, a very comprehensive job in reviewing the record, and that's why it's so long. But you want the elevator speech of what the opinion says, and basically it says this, that the voter ID law erected obstacles to voting. And these obstacles to voting included the limited kinds of IDs that were acceptable, the expiration date, the exclusive distribution at the driver's license centers, which not every county has, and it's hard to get to, and the misleading and confusing ad campaign, and that these barriers prevented people from getting ID, and that violated the Supreme Court standard of liberal access. That was number one. And number two is that these barriers to voting were impermissible burdens on the constitutional right to vote. That was the second holding. And that because they were going to prevent voters, just as you said, if people were going to be disenfranchised, therefore we were entitled to stop it before somebody could get disenfranchised.
So I listened to that, and you know, that's much easier than trying to work through 103 pages.
Right.
But here again, I go back to it seems to me the right decision. As we go forward, what are the obstacles going forward in the Supreme Court? Because I'm going to assume that since it is taxpayer money, I'm assuming that the governor's office is going to appeal this because This is a kind of a cornerstone thing that they enacted. What are the obstacles going forward?
Well, they haven't announced that they're going to appeal. I have not found a statement from the Office of General Counsel yet today. So, but let's assume that they do appeal. We think that this is a very strong opinion that can be defended on appeal. And also, because the judge was the fact finder, that means that his findings can only be overturned if they're clearly erroneous or there's an abuse of discretion. It's a really hard standard to overturn the factual findings that he made. And if he's made an error of law, that would be the Supreme Court could review that. So that would be a potential obstacle. But we have essentially the same court that we had in 2012, where there's one more justice who was appointed to fill the vacancy. We'll have to wait and see whether they appeal. But if they appeal, of course, we will vigorously defend this decision.
Right. And then going forward, because, I think about all the money that was wasted and how do you undo all the damage that's already done? Because I actually, when this came out, I talked to a couple of people that I came across on the street and, just to ask questions, because I do that sometimes. And they still think to this day, you got to have an ID every time you vote, because it's been ingrained in them. The advertising campaign worked.
Well, the law has never been in effect for any election because we were able to halt it from the beginning. But because of the misleading ad campaign, you're right, people think they do need ID. But it would seem there's no order. The court hasn't ordered that they spend any money to correct that, but they are enjoined from continuing to say that people need ID under Act 18. So we would hope that the Commonwealth would do the right thing and have an education campaign to correct the misinformation that's been sent out there. I mean, I think the court was pretty clear that their education campaign had misled voters. So I would hope that they would do that.
So anything in the order that would say you've got to undo the damage you've done and do just as vigorous? Because, look, I mean, you see these big stories all over the front page of the newspaper, then you find out a couple of weeks later they were wrong, and there's a little retraction down on page A17 at the very bottom near the advertisement for trash removal. Are we going to see that kind of thing?
Well, there's certainly nothing in the order that's not the remedy that the judge ordered. He basically put a halt to Act 18 as it relates to the showing of ID in person. So it's a much broader injunction. This is a permanent injunction, and it's much broader than what was already in place. So it's really the voter ID law truly now is not in effect, and poll workers aren't going to be able to ask for ID like they did before, and there's going to be no show it campaign can't be run anymore. We don't know what the secretary is going to do in order to educate voters about what really are the requirements, but there's nothing in the order that says they have to undo the damage. No.
Now, is there any way that you could get that groups like yours, like the Advancement Project or others, would push for something like that? I mean, to begin litigating, to say, you did this, now you got to undo it. Is that even possible?
Well, it's actually, that's a great question that we, believe me, this has been a very busy day, and we're still digesting the entire opinion, but it's certainly something to consider.
Well, I'm sure it's been an extremely busy day because this is a huge national decision. Because you see this voter suppression, this wasn't just something that our legislators, were stirring around in the middle of the night, dreaming upon and kept them up nights. This was a national plan. This was something that was set in their lap. And you could say it was by the American Legislative Exchange Council. You could say it was by the very well-to-do in Wall Street. Whoever it is, this was not something that the citizens of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania were begging for, and there wasn't rampant fraud. This was something that was imposed on this state by outside interests and all across the country by outside interests.
I think that's right. I think that we saw a huge a spate of the same kinds of legislation across the country in 2011 and 2012 leading up to the presidential election, and I think for the purpose of making it harder for people to vote. And I think you're right. I don't think that this was something that was enacted because of the interests of Pennsylvania. I think it was part of this national plan. So, but I think what's important about the decision is that we, that the court recognized that we have a strong constitutional right to vote in Pennsylvania's constitution, and he enforced it to protect the right to vote, and he also recognized that we had built a very compelling record of people who were going to be disenfranchised. And I think that's very important, and I think that shows, I think the record in this case shows to other states, look, this is what happens when restrictive voter ID laws are enacted. People don't get to vote,
right.
And there, it's against the Constitution.
And I, the way you put it there, I think, is important and needs to be reiterated. And absolute, this is a right. This is each individual citizen of this country's absolute right. And any of those, to me, any barriers between that, I think is unconstitutional. When you think about it in the frame that this was, they said from the beginning, we don't know of anything that this would have ever stopped, but we're going to do it anyway.
Right, and I think the court really discredited that and said, look, even if there is a possibility or a risk that there's fraud, that it was such a small, low, this exceedingly rare in-person voter fraud just couldn't justify the kinds of barriers and burdens that this voter ID law presented to the voters of Pennsylvania.
So just to wrap this up, the bottom line, no voter ID when you go to the polls unless it's your first time, which is what the law was. And this is the end of it. That's it. Unless there's an appeal from the governor's office, which you think maybe may not happen?
Well, I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, we assumed that they would appeal, but, we haven't. I thought that they would have announced it right away, but we haven't really heard from the governor's office today. And I think that the attorney general had said she was waiting to see what the governor's office was going to do. So,
all in all, a good day.
Wait and see. Well, but it was a good day.
A good day, a reason to celebrate a little bit. Don't pop the cork just yet, but a reason to celebrate. Marianne Snyder, I appreciate the time. It was great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Marianne's a senior attorney at the Advancement Project, advancementproject.org, if you want to take a look at the work that they do. Let's take a quick break, back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show for working people. Come to talk.
In an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. This week, the Senate released the results of its investigation into the 2012 Benghazi attacks. The bipartisan report dispelled many of Fox News' favorite conspiracy theories surrounding the attacks, including the myth that the Obama administration engaged in some sort of cover-up of the attacks. Yet Fox host Bill O'Reilly continued to push these myths, peppering guest James Carville with questions about the origins of Susan Rice's suggestion that the attacks may have originated from a protest over an anti-Islamic film. Listen to Carville attempt to explain that the Senate report answered O'Reilly's question.
As Director Petraeus said, and as the committee said, that was consistent with what the intelligence community was saying.
No, that's not what the Senate said.
You look at the report,
opposite.
And that's what they said.
I don't care about that.
Again,
I don't care about the bloody report. You don't know the answer to that question at all.
Why are you covering the report if you don't care about it?
Fox News' heavy coverage of the Senate report has consistently ignored the facts in the report in order to smear the administration's response. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Who says the economy is down and that consumers aren't willing to spend in order to stimulate new economic growth? The problem with gloomy economists and skittish policymakers is that they don't know where to look for signs that boom times are back, baby. For example, take auto sales. Yeah, overall, they're putzing along at a moderate to low pace, but open your eyes, people. Do you not see that Maserati sales were up 55% last year? Or that Rolls-Royce, Lamborghini, Porsche, and Bentley also produced double-digit increases? Listen to Matt Lavin, a Cleveland high roller who told the New York Times that he bought 3 Mercedes last year. One for $237,000, another for $165,000, and an auxiliary $97,000 number for his wife. Extravagant? It's all a matter of perspective. I look at it as I don't have a boat, Matt explains. There you go. Economics is all about having a positive attitude. So, with a booming stock market, high-tech wealth bubbling like crazy, and Fortune 500 CEOs making big bales of hay while the sun shines, what's not to like about America's economic future? An automotive lifestyle consultant told The Times, luxury is not a dirty word anymore. Now, isn't that a telling insight? You see, when Wall Street crashed 6 years ago, then got bailed out by Washington while the middle class sank, many of your 1%ers and higher got squeamish about living the luxurious life they deserve. But that's not the American way. Hey, if you've got it, flaunt it. This is Jim Hightower saying, surely we can all see the social value of top-end buyers who are willing to step up and make big-ticket purchases again. By leading the consumer charge, these bold luxury buyers are providing a role model that your lower classes need to do their own part in reviving America's economy.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Every now and then I visit an elementary school. Talking with children is a pretty good idea, I think. They ask questions we don't think about, and they ask them very directly. Recently, a little girl wanted to know, what's the hardest part of your job? That got me thinking. I looked down and I told her, the hardest part is telling people no.
You know, you listen to that. You listen to him say that. You know, I visit public schools. I visit schools and elementary schools, and I visit. You got to ask the question, did he make that up? Is that something he imagined? Was that a conversation he dreamt up while he went, when he wakes up at 3 o'clock in the morning worrying about things? Is that something that you know, like kind of like Ronald Reagan's welfare queen, really wasn't something that actually was? It's kind of a construct, kind of a mishmash of anecdote and make-believe. Do you think he really had that conversation with a little girl, or do you think he was making it up? Because understand, this guy has not, in his time as governor, and this blew my mind when I found this out today, he has yet to make an appearance at a public school. He's gone to a couple charter schools, all in favor of the charter schools. But this is supposedly the first time he was going to make it to a district-run public school. Now, the idea was he was going to give out the award, the Governor's Award for Excellence in Academics, and he was going to give it out to Carver High School, Central High School, and Julia R. Masterman Laboratory and Demonstration School. But there were people there, people who didn't like what he has done to education, people who have said, you know, you've been gutting education for the last 3 years. The classrooms are bigger. The funding is lower. In fact, the Philadelphia Public School District, the school district there is in the midst of the worst financial crisis that anyone can remember, because this guy is starving the public schools while heavily funding, well, actually taking money from the public schools and giving it to the charter schools. Divide and conquer. Anyone who has any rational thinking skills realizes that once you split the pot in half, you have problems. And this is what they're doing. They're pitting people against one another and, well, you know, heavily funding the charter schools, because I love the provision of law. And this is one of those moments where you just kind of shake your head and go, why would they do that? Understand, the charter schools get the revenue from the previous year. So whatever they were getting the previous year, they get at least that. So when the governor cut $1 billion from education, that first year, it didn't happen to them. And in fact, while they were cutting money to the public schools, more was being lost because it was having to be made up to the charter schools. I mean, it's really a blatant attempt to destroy public education in favor of these charter schools. But he bailed on these kids who, you know, say what you want, if they're getting the governor's award for excellence in academics, they've got to be working their butts off. And this would have been, you know, I don't care who it is, when a high-ranking official comes to hand your school an award because you've done a good job, I don't care who it is, Democrat, Republican, red, green, blue, I don't care. That's something to be proud of. So you've got to think that these kids who were expecting the governor of their state to come to their school and say, you guys are doing a great job. We need to do more things like you, and to pat them on the back and say congratulations or whatever. You got to think that there was something for them, and they were jazzed up, and they were. But he bailed on them. I mean, he bailed on these kids like this. You know, I got to be honest. If I'm the sitting governor, you deal with the crowds that are unhappy with you. But you do what you said you were going to do. So when he's running around the state saying promise kept, not today. Absolutely not today. And when you bail on these kids like this, I mean, it's ludicrous in my view. And I really thought that while he was there today, he was going to take the opportunity to say that, well, you know, we're going to add money to public education. We're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars in new education funding. In fact, that's what kind of they're expecting for his budget address that's coming up in a couple of weeks, that he's going to add, you know, some money to education. Nobody knows how much. There've been numbers thrown all over, anywhere from 50 to 200 million. But understand, when you've cut $1 billion each of the last 3 years, 50 million not going to help the entire state. I'm not talking about just the Philadelphia school district. I'm talking the entire state. So when you're talking about 50 million, 100 million, it sounds like a lot of money. It's not. Not in the context of an entire educational system and the structure of the state. But I thought he was going to take that moment and pursue that. Not so much. And, you know, you look at these schools that, you know, I get the opportunity to talk with teachers from around the state and the stories that they tell. And, I spend time talking to my kids' teachers. This is a tough job. Standing in front of a classroom teaching 25, 30 kids, 50 kids, it's a tough job. And to have a political structure, a media structure, a societal structure almost, that demonizes teachers. Oh, you're greedy. Oh, you make too much. Oh, you got pensions. We need to reform that, take it away. And then to get up every day and go in there and deal with all of the things that are coming, these idiotic tests, the administration who's got the curriculum that's handed down to them that is the corporate version of education. It's no wonder to me. You know, the last couple of years where my kids go to school, it's no wonder to me that a number of the very good teachers have left. You know, and I think of the guy who was the third grade teacher for my daughter a couple of years ago, who we were really hoping would stay around till our kids got through, because he was fantastic. And there were a number of those who were just fantastic teachers, but they got tired of being robots. They got tired of not being given the opportunity to actually teach. And what we're turning teachers into are factory workers, punching out little stamps. There's a little minion. There's a little minion. I'll fill in the right bubble. We've got to take our education back. And the funding that this guy's putting into it, we need a new governor, man. We need somebody who's going to invest in our kids' futures. And you go, but Rick, we're broke, right? No, we're not broke. We're giving billions of dollars away in corporate tax breaks. We're giving money away hand over fist under the guise of that it's going to create jobs. Under the guise of economic development. And I'm sorry, you know, when you look at the numbers, anywhere from 47th to 49th in the country in job creation, when we're giving our future away to these companies, I got to tell you, that's just not the way to go. And you look at all the time, energy, the money, the resource, everything that we've wasted over the last 3 years, all of the opportunities that have been wasted the last 3 years on all of these ridiculous schemes. This voter ID thing was just another in a long laundry list of harebrained schemes brought to us by the corporate class. Aren't you angry? Aren't you frustrated? I mean, Can you look at and see this? The voter suppression, the Act 13 takes away, taking away local control away from local towns and municipalities, saying the state will tell you who's going to drill on your land and you've got no say in it. That gerrymandering, where it took a woman from Allentown to figure it out, to say, hey, I could do that better. I got a map and a pencil, do it much better. And she did. And you just go down the list. You know, the money we've wasted advertising a voter suppression law that wasn't even in place. The money we've spent on illegal fees trying to sell off the management of the lottery system. All of the time and the years and the money and everything that we've spent on privatizing the liquor stores. All of this stuff. Absolutely the wrong priorities, don't you think? Can you make a justification for this guy on any level? To say, oh, yeah, that's the way we should have gone. See, because I can't. Just can't do it. And I see the next 6 months being more of the same. More bad priorities, more bad policy, more ALEC-type legislation, more outside influence. You know, I didn't hear anybody calling for the privatization of the wine and spirit shops yet. We've spent a couple of years doing this. And a lot of time. I heard no one saying, hey, let's sell off the lottery. Spent almost a year doing that. Millions of dollars. You know, the things that I actually want, the things that I actually hear people talking about, the kids getting a good education. The pothole on the way to work getting filled. The bridge being secured so that it doesn't crumble. It doesn't collapse and we end up in the drink. That's the stuff I think people are interested in, not the divisive stuff. Just that simple. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the Texas charter schools run by Responsive Education Solutions. Oh, some wonderful stuff coming out of there. Can't wait to get to it and don't want to miss it. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
January of 1964 was a time to remember for many Americans. The Beatles released their first album. New York announced plans to build a World Trade Center. The Surgeon General announced smoking kills, and President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty during his first State of the Union address. January 1964 was also a momentous year for the American truck drivers. The nation's truckers saw the first nationwide labor contract. The National Master Freight Agreement, covering some 450,000 truck drivers employed by 16,000 companies across the country, set a nationwide minimum wage of $3.33 per hour, or $23.63 in 2008 dollars, as well as providing health care and retirement benefits for all its members. The 1964 National Master Freight Agreement set a nationwide standard for working conditions, giving drivers a voice on the job and the power to stand up to abusive treatment and eventually the ability to refuse to drive equipment the driver deemed unsafe. Led by labor visionary James R. Hoffa, this victory was the crowning achievement of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters as one of America's most influential unions. This landmark agreement created a framework for all national contracts to follow. Jimmy Hoffa, the man who famously quipped, "I may have many faults, being wrong is not one of them," was certainly right about the benefits, power, and influence of such a national agreement for workers, both union and non-union. Wages and benefits earned by truck drivers brought millions of hard-working men and women solidly into the middle class by rewarding hard work with a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. For generations, the National Master Freight Agreement served as the industry standard for all truck drivers, raising wages, improving benefits, and providing a safer workplace for drivers and the motoring public. Unfortunately, since the 1980 passage of trucking deregulation, the industry has resorted to cutthroat competition based on who was willing to work for less. In this environment, the National Master Freight Agreement has lost some of its power in lifting truck drivers out of low wage, no benefit, and hazardous conditions. Currently, many non-union truck drivers are earning at or near poverty wages while pushing legal limits. For many truckers, their pay is solely determined by the number of miles they drive. Breakdowns, time spent waiting to be loaded and unloaded, and other delays are shouldered by the driver, in most cases without compensation. 1964 and the years that followed has shown what can be accomplished by workers standing together. Perhaps the future will see resurgence in worker solidarity and the reemergence of a fair day's work, a fair day's pay. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
Texas is a right-to-work state. Texas is a great state. We could be the Texas of the Northeast.
Cause in the real world they're shutting Detroit down, while the boss man takes his bonus pay and jets on out of town.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Yes, we could be the Texas of the Northeast. And with this whole push towards charter schools, what are we going to be teaching our kids in the near future? Are we going to be going down the path of the responsive education solutions curriculum? Which, you know, you look at some of the very interesting things. Now, understand this. This organization, Responsive Education Solutions, they have 17,000 students, according to the article that I read. More than 65 schools. Takes in about $82 million in taxpayer money each and every year. And what it appears that they're pushing from some of the things that have been acquired, some workbooks and stuff, is they're basically pushing this extreme I don't even want to call it conservative Christian, this extreme right-wing view of not just history, but, you know, they're pushing their creationism stuff, you know, saying in the one workbook that, you know, it's their knowledge unit in their biology textbook. In the beginning, God created the heavens and earth. Came out of the Bible, I think. If you want to teach the Bible, I'm okay with, you know, you're learning the Bible, but not in a biology class. And then they go on to question all of the, you know, how old the earth is and fuel and fossils and all of that stuff. Basically, every one of your creationist arguments, that's what is now being taught as science. And, you know, they throw out the claim that scientists question the validity of the conclusions concerning the age of the earth, which, you know, I love their history, though. They have a history knowledge unit that's scary on a bunch of levels. The one of the first ones that I came across is they point out they claim that the First World War was the result of the country abandoning religious standards of conduct. I'm not quite sure how that happened, but, you know, they claim that began with the Enlightenment, that we moved away from God, and that's why God, I guess, put us in the war. They said the new deal ushered in a new era of dependency on the federal government, and feminists created a class of women who lacked male financial support and who had to turn to the state as a surrogate husband. Kind of makes you go back and think a lot about what's being said here about by a number of these female talk show hosts. I just find it eerie that there's this thought process. Now, I've got two daughters. I want them to at some point down the road to get married, to be happy, have children if they choose, lead the life that they forge for themselves. This idea that, and this is what, there's a movement in this country that scares the hell out of me. But there's a movement of, you know, the third of the population who don't believe in evolution, that women's place back in the home, barefoot pregnant, this idea that they should be subservient to men, that they need to have men to have a fulfilled life. And, you know, I see all of this stuff. It's kind of scares the hell out of me. Because, again, I've got two daughters, and I want them to be everything that they can possibly be, not dependent. And I find it interesting that they say, you know, women became dependent on the federal government, so better to be dependent on an abusive husband, right? Is that what I'm getting? And I think, yeah, I think in that view, that's kind of what they would want. But this battle over our education system, and it's sadly, understand, rational thought is losing. Rational, common sense thought is losing this debate. The militant right wing of this country is winning. And they're winning because, well, the moneyed interests want it that way. Understand, the moneyed interests want subservient people. They want people who know their place. They want us just smart enough to press buttons, do the work, and really not smart enough to fight back or to question. I want my kids to question. And I would hope everyone does. I would hope every parent wants their child to go, you know what? If something seems wrong to you, ask a question about it. Think about it. Not just accept. And to me, what we're doing with education, not what I see as positive for the coming generation. Especially when we start looking at the fact that we're mechanizing at an alarming pace, and that everything is turning digital. It just is what it is. Isn't it angering on a number of levels? Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break right here. When we come back, going to talk a little bit about what's going on in Memphis with the locked out workers at Kellogg. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone, right back. Stick around.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The National Labor Relations Board complained against Walmart this week as the board's largest ever complaint against an employer. It alleges that Walmart illegally fired and disciplined workers for using their legal rights to speak out for better jobs in 14 states at 34 stores. The NLRB says Walmart broke federal labor law, violating workers' rights by retaliating against them for job actions, strikes, and protests aimed at improving their jobs. 63 store managers are named, as well as a Walmart spokesman and vice president of communications, accused of being responsible for illegal threats against workers. Barbara Collins was fired by the company. She says Walmart workers have a right to speak out and won't be silenced. The coalition of Immokalee workers had very different Walmart news on Thursday. They announced an agreement with Walmart to join the Fair Food Program to benefit farm workers. The coalition of Immokalee workers said Walmart agreed to work with the workers' organization and Walmart's Florida tomato suppliers to strengthen and expand the Fair Food Program. program gets companies to pay a small increase in the price they pay for tomatoes to concretely and directly benefit farm workers. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers is working to improve working conditions and pay in the fields and says it's pleased to welcome Walmart into the Fair Food Program. Michigan's appeals court this week upheld a 2012 law that cut pensions for public school employees by requiring them to put more of their wages into the pension system. Michigan's American Federation of Teachers had challenged the constitutionality of the law. The law imposed what amounts to a $15 billion pensions cut on the public school workers. Despite that huge hit on their pensions, the court ruled it did not violate Michigan's constitutional ban on diminishing public worker pensions. The court said it didn't diminish current vested pension benefits, just future benefits. That same law eliminated employer-provided health care for new hires in Michigan public schools. 30 workers at a Delaware Amazon warehouse voted against joining the International Association of Machinists. That vote was 21-6 against union representation. The IAM said Amazon worked behind the scenes to turn workers against the union. The union said workers faced intense pressures from managers and anti-union consultants hired to suppress the organizing drive. But IAM Eastern District spokesman John Carr says the IAM won't give up on organizing Amazon workers. Unions in Los Angeles are promoting a $15 minimum wage. The Los Angeles City Council is expected to introduce a minimum wage ordinance soon. Unions in L.A. released a report this week from the Economic Roundtable that says more than 810,000 residents of Los Angeles make less than $15 an hour. The unions have put up city limits billboards downtown on the city's west side and near the airport. They say Los Angeles, city limited. Poverty wage population, 810,864. The Economic Roundtable report says that 46% of workers in Los Angeles make less than $15 an hour, and a citywide raise to $15 would be enough economic stimulus to create 67,400 new jobs in Los Angeles County.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Something is happening in our world. The masses of people are rising up, and wherever they are assembled today, whether they are in Johannesburg, South Africa, Nairobi, Kenya, Accra, Ghana, New York City, Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, or Memphis, Tennessee, the cry is always the same: we want to be free.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. You know, you look at the MLK Day just around the corner. His birthday was just the other day. And you go and, you know, when we were on our labor history tour over the summer, we stopped in Memphis to see the place where Dr. King was murdered. And the reason, you know, the reason we were there, highlighting the fact that he was there fighting for better wages, better hours, better conditions for those sanitation workers. And what just blew my mind is to this day, those sanitation workers, they still don't have a pension. They have no retirement security. And while we were there, we found out that, you know, they've got guys 70 years old still working on the garbage truck. And in fact, just a couple of months before we were there, a guy over the age of 70 died on the job because he didn't have he didn't have the ability to retire. Something seriously, seriously wrong. And also in Memphis, if you remember back in October, we talked about this. The Kellogg Company locked out their employees, some 200 workers that they kicked to the curb because the worker said, "What? We're going to give up 30% of our jobs to casual labor? That doesn't sound right." Well, either you take it or to the curb. Well, they kicked them to the curb, which is why we've asked Kevin Bradshaw. He's the president of Local 252G, the Bakery and Confectionery Workers, to come talk to us. Kevin, thanks for taking time for us.
I appreciate you, Rick, for having me on. How are you doing?
I am good. You know, October 22nd, the company kicked you guys to the curb. And, you know, where are you? Where are you right now?
Well, unfortunately, Rick, we're still out on the street, and we're also waiting on the NLRB to give us some type of ruling or decision on the actual process of the charges that have been filed against the company.
And this idea of 30% casual hours in a company that already cut, I guess, some 60 jobs prior to this, that just seemed to be like your own, signing your own death warrant almost.
Yeah, but Rick, let me correct you on that, if I may.
Please.
30%, The 30% is what we actually were willing to give the company.
Oh.
Already negotiated. They wanted 100%. They were saying that everyone hired from this point would no longer receive the same benefits, no insurance, and less wages than what you hire. And they'll never be a regular employee.
Whoa, wait a second. Stop. Wow. So they're saying that, you know, no more full-time status. We're going to have just all temporary people who are never going to have any rights and never going to have any security? Really?
Yes.
And they thought you would take this?
Yes, they did. They did that because they thought they could make it weak by giving away 50 million pounds of our product to our sister and plants all over the world and also to Mexico. And by doing that, that would allow us to be so weak and so scared just to keep the plant alive that we would fall in and say yes. But then they just announced a month ago that they're shutting the London, Ontario plant down, which they gave 43 million pounds of our rice to.
Now, as I understand it, the facility in Memphis that you work at or that you've been kicked to the curb at, they got state money. There's, as I understand it, there's a huge tax incentive that the people of your area said, we want these jobs. We want good full-time middle-class jobs, and we're going to give you some tax dollars for it. Am I getting this right?
That's absolutely correct. They have a pilot program, which is payment in lieu of taxes, that they have since 2003 to 2018, which they lied to us about, saying that they wanted the union to be able to go before the city council try to help negotiate the new tax incentives, which they already had the whole time.
So they asked the union to go vouch for them and fight for them to get tax breaks so that they could keep full-time jobs, and they turn around and jab you in the back like this?
Yeah, they jab us in the back. They lie. They use people to help train supervisors to show them how to do our jobs to prepare to lock us out. This was all a well-devised plan to lock us out. From the beginning, they never had any intentions on bargaining in good faith.
So, now, as you're moving towards the NLRB, because I've got to imagine that this is something that the NLRB is going to not take lightly, and I would hope hold them in contempt and punish them. But in the meantime, you've got 200 people, 200 families that are struggling.
Yes, we're struggling, but unfortunately, we've been able to receive support from the city of Memphis. All the other brothers and sisters, locals all over the world, and, you know, we have a hardship fund, local 252G hardship fund at First Tennessee Bank, you know, and that's been helping out with, you know, just a few things, but it's not covering everything. But we're alive and we're still standing long and we're standing strong.
Because understand, and our listeners understand, that you fighting in Memphis to maintain good, solid, middle-class union jobs means that maybe somewhere else in the country those jobs are going to be secure. And if the fight's in your backyard, the fight's with us as well.
Oh, yeah. It's coming to a place near you soon if we don't win here in Memphis.
Yeah, I understand. On Monday, there's going to be since it is Dr. King Day. I understand you guys are having an event. Tell me about it.
Yeah, the first event is going to be the King Day Parade, which has been going on for about 30 years, and we'll be involving there probably over 3,000 to 4,000 people marching down downtown Memphis to the Civil Rights Museum. And the second event is going to be a 2 p.m. event that's going to be at Cane Creek Baptist Church, 1785 Bellevue. With all our international brothers and sisters, our president of International Union, Dave Durkee, and all other senior officers from everywhere will be in town, and a lot of local unions and everyone else will be there, and it's sponsored by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which we all know Martin Luther King was a part of.
Right. You know, and I go back to the dream, if you will. And for me, the dream had everything to do not just with racial desegregation, but also economic equality. Everybody having an opportunity to make a decent living, to be able to support their families. And I look at what's going on with you guys and this race to the bottom mentality where we're allowing companies to devise this kind of plan where negotiating is now saying, well, you're going to have to slit your own throat or you'll have to do it yourself.
Yeah, there's so many backhanded deals made here in the city of Memphis with our politicians and local government that have, you know, been overran with just a lot of under-the-table deals with bringing in low-wage jobs and giving a lot of companies big-time tax breaks and incentives and benefits. So, well, this is a distribution hub, and now Kellogg wants to dig into that and use it as a way well, we're paying this much. Why should we pay this much when everyone else is paying less? Well, you pay that much because you can afford to pay that much. And that's just the message we're trying to send to Kellogg instead of trying to make this into a new type of modern-day slavery and cut the wages and benefits and insurance just because they want to, not because they need to, just because they want to.
And because they can. Now, this is a very profitable company. I mean, they're like a $14, $15 billion a year company.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. $14.2 billion. They bought Pringles for $2.8 billion in cash. And they make about $1 million a day in a cereal plant, in our cereal plant. I mean, $326 million a quarter. I mean, there's money on top of money. And, you know, they waste a lot of money on buying back their own stock, you know, to make the price go up and make people want to buy it or whatever, and then want to come back and try to take away the labor and reduce the cost to get back that cash on hand that they ultimately just gave away from buying back their own stock.
Yeah, well, they run that up so that their CEOs can pocket more of their cash from that. And I got to imagine, you know, if you're talking about a $14.2 billion company, your CEO, I'm sure, is not working for poverty wages.
No, $6.6 million a year, and that's just a salary.
And then you throw on top of that all of the incentives, all of the stock options, all of the perks that aren't even counted, the jets, the homes, all of the stuff that comes with it. It's obscene on so many levels. And then to turn around.
He's not even from America. That's one reason. He's living the American dream, but he's not even American.
Oh, wow. And then you turn around. Then you turn around and you say, screw you. You're making 15, 16 bucks an hour. You're not going to make 10 or 12. And the sad reality, Kevin, is that's the story that's been replicated all across this country as labor unions have been weakened, as the Wall Street attacks on organizing have continued. And they're here in Pennsylvania as well. But as we've demonized unions and gone after them, this is what's happened to all of us. Our wages, our standard of living, all declining because our power to organize and to bargain has been so badly assaulted.
You're correct.
And I think the answer is exactly what you guys are doing there in Memphis, standing together, standing tall, and getting the message out and telling people, hey, look, we're not going to roll over and play dead. We're going to fight.
That's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to fight to the end. We're going to stand at least one day longer than they will, and that's what we got to do.
Now, are we boycotting? Are we boycotting any products?
Well, a lot of people outside our organization on BCTGM have started announcing that they're going to start boycotting and everything else. You know, and we can't tell people what to do and what not to do. We appreciate any type of support they want to do. But I would recommend they call 1-800-962-1413, the Kellogg's hotline number, and tell them that they don't want to buy any more scab plates. They want real frosty plates with real workers from America to make decent wage.
Tell me that number again.
1-800-962-1413. Or they can go to Kellogg's.com also.
I will go, and as soon as the show is over, I'm calling the line. Because, look, I don't want to buy scab flakes either. But they make a whole lot of things. And I don't think many people know how big of a company Kellogg actually is. Like, I didn't know they made Famous Amos cookies.
Yeah. Pringles, Keebler, Cheez-It, Eggo Waffles, Nutri-Grain Bars, Morningstar Farm, Bare Naked Incorporated, Sunshine Biscuits. I mean, the list goes on. I mean, they make a whole lot of different things.
So the workers who make those products, what's going to happen to them if we allow you guys to be assaulted, if we allow this theft to happen to you? What happens to the rest of them?
Well, the ultimate plan of Kellogg's is to get rid of unions. I mean, and that's what their plan is, to create this two-tier wage system all over the world and put everyone on the same level of labor, the same price, the same everything, no insurance, no benefits. And it's going to happen to them. Like I said, we're fighting a fight for everyone else. That's why we're getting so much support from everyone else, because they know this is not just not our fight, it's their fight as well.
So let's say they win this. For people who don't get it, because I have some listeners who think, well, we don't need unions. That's something of the past. You know, back in the Industrial Revolutions, we needed it, but we're so much better now, so much more advanced. The companies are such good, benevolent people. They would never do things to harm us. What does America look like without labor unions, without contracts, without the ability to collectively bargain? What do you think of that?
Without any of that, I can say it's just new age, a new type of slavery, new modern day slavery. I mean, you might as well get ready for it. Self-preservation after that. I mean, if we lose this fight, we're going to lose everything as we know it.
Yeah, and the sad reality, Kevin, is, you know, people talk about, oh, you know, we're going back to the days of slavery. And I say, no, we're not going back to the days of slavery. We're going back to something much worse than that. At least back in the days of slavery, they at least had to somewhat feed you and take care of you because they kind of owned you. Now they just want to rent you long enough to get what they need, and then they kick you off to die on your own.
Right.
They just want to use you long enough to break you and send you down the road. And that's the sad reality of what's going on in this country.
Yeah. One day they're looking for $15 an hour, next day they're looking for $12, next day they're looking for $10, and you know, it just goes to the bottom. Like you said, it's the race to the bottom.
Yeah. You know, the other day I heard someone say that the minimum wage is $7.25 is too high. It should be $4 an hour. And then you heard someone else say, no, it should be $2 an hour. And the question is how low can you go? Will we end up back where we were during the Depression, where we'll work for food was too much? It's sad stuff. How can we help, Kevin? How can our listeners help? How can I help the folks out there who have been kicked to the curb by Kellogg Company?
I can say, like I said, you can call that number and stress to me that you don't want to buy scab flakes. We have a Facebook page, BCTGM Memphis. We have an international page, BCTGM.org. You can go on there and, you know, look at the contact leads and share whatever type of information or find any type of contacts you want to. They have a hardship fund, which is set up through the First Tennessee Bank called Local 252G Hardship Fund. If you want to donate money, you can go that way, and that'll help our members that are struggling with different type of finances to be able to offset some type of hardship that they have. And you can call us. Our office number is 901-396-1499 if you need more information. Any type of support, I would say, whatever you want to do that you think that's going to be supportive to the union and the working men and working families and the working women, we appreciate it.
Yeah, so, to me, send money. Send money to the people who are defending the American dream, defending the American middle class. And at the barest minimum, call Kellogg and tell them no scab flakes. Kevin, I'm right with you. I wish you guys nothing but the best. And as this continues, I'd love to have you come back again, hopefully in a victorious fashion.
Sounds good, Rick. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Kevin Brady, president of Local 252G of the BCTGM. Quick break, back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show for working people from the talk.
Show. Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been talking about our original American Pledge of Allegiance written by Francis Bellamy in 1892. When introduced in October of that year as part of a Columbus Day program, it was well received and spread rapidly. At the urging of Bellamy, a salute was also adopted with the right arm extended toward the flag while reciting the pledge. Though popular, well used, and effective, the pledge and salute were changed 5 times over the next 62 years. The first added the word to before the phrase, the republic for which it stands. The next change came in 1923 at the urging of the National Flag Conference, which wanted to replace the words my flag to flag of the United States so new immigrants wouldn't confuse loyalties. And the words of America after United States were added in 1924. Join us again as Congress takes control. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Who says the economy is down and that consumers aren't willing to spend in order to stimulate new economic growth? The problem with gloomy economists and skittish policymakers is that they don't know where to look for signs that boom times are back, baby. For example, take auto sales. Yeah, overall, they're putzing along at a moderate to low pace, but open your eyes, people. Do you not see that Maserati sales were up 55% last year? Or that Rolls-Royce, Lamborghini, Porsche, and Bentley also produced double-digit increases? Listen to Matt Lavin, a Cleveland high roller who told the New York Times that he bought 3 Mercedes last year. One for $237,000, another for $165,000, and an auxiliary $97,000 number for his wife. Extravagant? It's all a matter of perspective. I look at it as I don't have a boat, Matt explains. There you go. Economics is all about having a positive attitude. So, with a booming stock market, high-tech wealth bubbling like crazy, and Fortune 500 CEOs making big bales of hay while the sun shines, what's not to like about America's economic future? An automotive lifestyle consultant told The Times, luxury is not a dirty word anymore. Now, isn't that a telling insight? You see, when Wall Street crashed 6 years ago, then got bailed out by Washington while the middle class sank, many of your 1%ers and higher got squeamish about living the luxurious life they deserve. But that's not the American way. Hey, if you've got it, flaunt it. This is Jim Hightower saying, surely we can all see the social value of top-end buyers who are willing to step up and make big-ticket purchases again. By leading the consumer charge, these bold luxury buyers are providing a role model that your lower classes need to do their own part in reviving America's economy. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. And again, you know, I suggest that you call the number. Call, hey, we don't want any scab flakes. 1-800-962-1413. 1-800-962-1413. Let's go to the phone lines. I've got Bob on line one. How you doing today, Bob?
Good evening. My name is Bob Oakley. I'm the chief negotiator for the union with the Kellogg Master Agreement.
Hey, I appreciate you calling in. What's going on?
Well, I heard the conversation with Kevin there, and I just want to make sure that, you know, that the listeners have all the information or at least more of it.
Please.
Yeah, what's going on here is this the master contract deals with certain issues, and those issues are generally based around, you know, hours, work conditions, pension, health care, and wages.
Yeah, exactly what union contracts are. What wages, hours, conditions.
Right, but there's two parts to it. The one part is what they call a supplemental agreement, and that's what some of the unions that you may be familiar with have local issues.
Correct.
There are issues that would apply to a local plant facility. Then what happens is they settle those local issues or supplemental agreements locally. After they get those issues resolved, we have a master contract that's scheduled to deal with the major issues. Now, we go to those negotiations, and we've been doing this for many years, and the issues that we deal with, as I just described to you, for the master contract. What they have done here after the master contract was settled, and during those negotiations, they raised these issues at the master. And we did not reach an agreement on them, but we agreed to take it to another forum, which would have been a union advisory committee,
right,
where we would meet up in Battle Creek. But they never brought it up after negotiations, and they figured out a different angle, that they would go back locally and raise the national issue.
So
that's where the unfair labor practices came from.
Okay, and that makes sense. Why did they pick Memphis?
Why they picked Memphis is because Memphis only makes one or two products. It's a limited operation. It's one of the smaller facilities, and they just simply had a scheduled shutdown because of capacity and inventory. They put them down for 2 weeks, and then they told them that, you know, you're not going to be coming back if you don't accept the terms that we're bargaining with right now. And it fit into the timing of the shutdown. So then we filed unfair labor practices with the labor board, and it's been over 2.5 months, and we've got little or no response from the board yet.
So let me ask you this, you know, and because, you know, the way this sounds is this was a scheme that they had devised probably long before you guys sat down at the bargaining table. This was probably their strategy to pick a small, weaker local, a smaller plant that they could absorb, just to make an example out of, to show the others you could be next. Am I getting that right?
Well, yeah, and I think Kevin raised that point that this is not a show that's not going to be shown at a theater near you. It's coming to you next, and they're going to go on to these other locations, you know, once they, if they would succeed here. But, you know, the economic picture of it, which I've heard Kevin mention some things, you know, just going back a few years, I've been doing this a long time. Next year I'll have 45 years with this union. I've been a chief negotiator for probably all since 1985 with Nabisco. I've been doing a contract with Keebler, who Kellogg's bought, who owns Famous Amos. They just bought Pringles. So there's plenty of money. You know, they're not having any hardship there. This is pure greed. Now, for the last 10 or 12 years, I've been doing a master contract with Kellogg, and they've raised these issues. But since then, you know, the previous CEO, David Mackay, his earnings was $12.3 million in 2008. It was 11.4 in 2009, and about 8 million in 2010. Now, since John Bryant came in, a lot of these CEO salaries have doubled. In 2010, John Bryant was making $3.5 million. Right now, he's making $6.5 million.
Wow. Well, he's doubled, Bob, because he's done such a successful job of screwing the workers. And understand, I mean, there's always been this, and I think our listeners get it, there's this push and pull between labor and capital. And now capital seems to have this hammer that they're crushing labor with.
Well, I think that they're on to some kind of new idea. You know, I mean, we have had little or no, I mean, we have about a 99% contract settlement rate for our whole international union. We have very few strikes. But today I think the company has come up with some new idea of the lockout.
Yeah.
You know, we had a situation up there in London, Ontario, not long ago, where they had an issue up there that they locked those people out. After we went and got it resolved to the company's benefit, now recently they announced the closing of that plant.
Jeez.
I think what they do is they try to pick out a plant. They know that they may close an operation or downsize, and they try to take advantage of one of the locations and try to use that. Now, you know, in the Kellogg North America reported sales in 2011 of a 5.6% growth. The retail cereal, they posted a 3.9% growth. And the North American retail snacks, and that's what includes Pringles, you know, you have Pop-Tart, the Eggo waffles, had a 4.7% increase. So there's no justification for what these people are doing other than greed. And what they do, as I said, you can see these salaries that are doubling. It's the big people taking from the little people.
No, and it's just not Kellogg. It's all over this country. And look, Bob, until we, as a society, wake up and push back against the assault against unions, push back against the rhetoric that unions are somehow bad. Until we push back on that and begin to organize and come together as a society, I don't see how these attacks stop until we say it has to stop.
Well, you know, it's like politicians understand both. Business people understand money. You know, unless you have leverage, and you can put these companies in a position, you know, to bargain fairly, they're going to take advantage of it. You know, it's the big people taking advantage of
yep.
the little people,
yep.
the risk taken from the poor. So, you know, I mean, as far as the unions are concerned, you need a union now more than you ever have. I mean, because they think that, you know, because you have some federal laws that protect people from age and race and political discrimination and things, but these employments are still at will.
Yep.
But they can put you out the door whenever they want. I mean, they're cutting a lot of different things. But then again, you know, the labor board hasn't been fair. We have a situation where we're in negotiation with this company in Blue Anchor, New Jersey. We told them we need a little more time to work on our issues because we're fearful of a lockout up there. They filed a charge. About 3 days later, the labor board called us up and said they wanted to take a deposition, an affidavit, December the 26th, the day after Christmas.
Wow.
2.5 months down there where we filed charges against the company, and they're still kicking the can down the road.
So let me ask you this, Bob, in about 30 seconds. What do we do? I mean, what's, especially on the Kellogg-Memphis thing, what do we want people to do? But overall, what's the message here for folks as they walk away from here?
I think Kellogg has always was concerned about their product, their image. We have to go public and keep it public, keep it in the eye. Yeah, you're right. This is happening all over the place. And if there's no success unless you have the ability to use that leverage. I believe we have the leverage with this company because we don't represent 20% of this company's workers. We have about 80 or 90% of this company's workers. And we have them in all the other, parts of the company. We don't just have cereal. We got their four major plants, which is 1,500 workers. I mean, you're slowly just as some of the other companies are. Take Nabisco, for example. You cannot buy a fig bar made in this country. But the American public goes in the store and never really takes a look at the packet.
Right.
You can't buy a York peppermint patty in this country.
Yeah, I know. That's why I always flip the package over and look for that union label.
Right, right. Well, I just wanted to step in there and tell you that Kevin Bradshaw and those people down there, my heart goes out for them. And this international union will do all they can. We have a very good leadership from our President Durkee, who will be going down there to stand with these people. And we are in this for the long haul, my friend.
And we're with you, Bob.
I'm the chief negotiator. And, I'm going to be there for these people, just as I said the rest of us will.
And we're going to be here as well for you, Bob. We'll be standing here with you as long as this takes. I wish you guys nothing but the best, and if there's anything we can do here at the Rick Smith Show, you've got a friend here.
We thank you, and God bless you.
Thanks so much, Bob. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The National Labor Relations Board complained against Walmart this week as the board's largest ever complaint against an employer. It alleges that Walmart illegally fired and disciplined workers for using their legal rights to speak out for better jobs in 14 states at 34 stores. The NLRB says Walmart broke federal labor law, violating workers' rights by retaliating against them for job actions, strikes, and protests aimed at improving their jobs. 63 store managers are named, as well as a Walmart spokesman and vice president of communications, accused of being responsible for illegal threats against workers. Barbara Collins was fired by the company. She says Walmart workers have a right to speak out and won't be silenced. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers had very different Walmart news. On Thursday, they announced an agreement with Walmart to join the Fair Food Program to benefit farm workers. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers said Walmart agreed to work with the workers' organization and Walmart's Florida tomato suppliers to strengthen and expand the Fair Food Program. The program gets companies to pay a small increase in the price they pay for tomatoes to concretely and directly benefit farm workers. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers is working to improve working conditions and pay in the fields and says it's pleased to welcome Walmart into the Fair Food Program. Michigan's appeals court this week upheld the 2012 law that cut pensions for public school employees by requiring them to put more of their wages into the pension system. Michigan's American Federation of Teachers had challenged the constitutionality of the law. The law imposed what amounts to a $15 billion pensions cut on the public school workers. Despite that huge hit on their pensions, the court ruled it did not violate Michigan's constitutional ban on diminishing public worker pensions. The court said it didn't diminish current vested pension benefits, just future
benefits. That same law eliminated employer-provided health care for new hires in Michigan public schools. 30 workers at a Delaware Amazon warehouse voted against joining the International Association of Machinists. That vote was 21-6 against union representation. The IAM said Amazon worked behind the scenes to turn workers against the union. The union said workers faced intense pressures from managers and anti-union consultants hired to suppress the organizing drive. But IAM Eastern District spokesman John Carr says the IAM won't give up on organizing Amazon workers. Unions in Los Angeles are promoting a $15 minimum wage. The Los Angeles City Council is expected to introduce a minimum wage ordinance soon. Unions in L.A. released a report this week from the Economic Roundtable that says more than 810,000 residents of Los Angeles make less than $15 an hour. The unions have put up city limits billboards downtown on the city's west side and near the airport. They say, Los Angeles, city limited. Poverty wage population, 810,864. The Economic Roundtable report says that 46% of workers in Los Angeles make less than $15 an hour, and a citywide raise to $15 would be enough economic stimulus to create 67,400 new jobs in Los Angeles County.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Everybody's got a price. Everybody's gonna pay. 'Cause the $1 million man always gets his way.
Yeah, the wealth class of this country, they always seem to get what they want. And you look at these free trade agreements, and I got to tell you, the more of them that we see, the worse they seem to get. And this latest one, and as you know, yesterday we talked about the Senate Finance Committee's hearing on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, and really this fast-track authority that they want to give, which just makes me shake my head and go, you know, when I was in school years and years ago, if you didn't do your homework and you said, I want someone else to do it, they frowned upon that. Now we've got a Congress who says, you can do it. Mr. President, you do our homework, even though a lot of us seem to hate you. Anyway, here to talk a little bit about what is in this agreement, what it means, what we should be looking for. I've asked Dr. Ken Paris, chief economist over at the Communication Workers of America, to come talk to us. Dr. Paris, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, thanks for inviting me.
You know, I look at this and the secrecy of this agreement. I don't really know what's in it. I only know what's been leaked, but the secrecy of it makes me immediately want to shy away from it.
Yes, shy is the correct word at the very least. Basically, it is what we've seen is so bad that if they publicly released the text of what they're discussing now, there would be massive outcry.
I think former U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk said it best, that if the TPP wasn't negotiated in secrecy, it would be so unpopular there's no way it could become law.
Absolutely. Representative Grayson from Florida was able to force the United States Trade Representative, that's the negotiating arm on these trade deals for the White House, the executive branch. He was able to get to see some of the text, and he was sworn to secrecy.
Yep.
He came out and said, I saw the text. It's a punch to the gut of the American middle class, but I can't tell you why.
Yeah, I remember we were out at Netroots Nation over the summer, when in the middle of our People's Tour for America, our Labor History Tour, and you know we got to, you know, on a round table, had an opportunity to ask some questions, and that's exactly what he said. I got to see some of it, but I'm sworn to secrecy, and I wanted to know, well, what could they do to a sitting U.S. congressman? What punishment could they possibly do?
A lot.
And that's the scary thing.
Yes, it really is a very undemocratic process, both in terms of the negotiation and in terms of this fast-track bill that was introduced by Senators Baucus and Hatch in the Senate and Representative Camp in the House. They haven't been able to get one Democratic member of the House to co-sponsor the bill yet. And fast-track basically does what it says. It's fast-track. It tries to railroad these trade deals that negotiated in secret without congressional input, but with the input of 600 corporate advisors who have access to the text, they're sworn to secrecy, but who cares? You know, they work with their a lot of lawyers and major corporate executives to push for what they want in these agreements.
Right.
Negotiated in secret. Our representatives really don't know what's in it. We don't know what's in it, except for some leaks. Three chapters have been leaked. One was the investment chapter. Another was the intellectual property chapter. And just last this week, the environmental chapter have been released. And each of them is a window on an expansion of corporate power and ostensibly profits at the expense of everyone else. This is pure pure agreement that would really help the 1% at the expense of everyone else. And I'll give a few examples. The investment chapter, it expands corporate rights so that a foreign corporation and multinationals, basically,
right,
can sue our government or the government of any other nation in this Trans-Pacific Partnership for any rule, law, or regulation that is a restraint of trade that inhibits their expected future profits or represents a change in the expected regulatory standard. And I'll give one example. This language was in other agreements. It was in NAFTA. And it allows corporations to sue government.
Okay.
There are 13 billion dollars in pending claims against countries due to these types of what they call investor state, this expansion of corporate right. So you can expect that there will, and most of these have to do with regulations protecting health,
right,
land use, energy, natural resources, environment, that corporations don't like. It impacts their expected future profit, and they sue. And it's not suing in our court system or any other governmental system. They take these suits to
a corporate
private
tribunal.
International tribunals, basically UN and World Bank tribunals, where three basically trade lawyers, you know who usually employs those type of people, make a ruling. And if they find in the favor of corporations, which they often do, they can mandate compensation be paid.
Yeah, so example, real quick thought, I think of cigarettes. Let's say we ban smoking in restaurants and bars and stuff like that. What you're saying is that tobacco companies could take us to the tribunal and say that you've put a trade barrier up by limiting the number of people and their ability to smoke. We want more smoking. Or, you know, the Joe the Camel thing. We probably couldn't go and ban cartoonish characters for cigarettes or that under these agreements, if I understand this right.
That's correct. And already there are suits against different countries precisely about tobacco regulations and labeling.
And then even further down the road, if we say we want to have high-speed rail or more public transportation, you could probably get the auto industry or the oil companies even to sue, saying, well, you're taking cars off the road who are using gasoline. I mean, this could really get ugly for the taxpayer down the road.
That's right. Like I said, there are $13, $14 billion in outstanding claims against different countries. So this elevates, just that investment chapter, elevates the status of corporations. We think it's bad enough that corporations are recognized as persons. Now they're recognized as more than persons. They're recognized at the level of nation states.
Wow.
Vast expansion. And it basically improves the security of their investment in different countries and reduces the risk. So that's an incentive to offshore more of our jobs to lower-paying countries. And an example of that in the TPP is Vietnam,
right,
who has a minimum wage of 28 cents an hour.
How do you
ours
compete
is low,
with that?
We figure, for $7.25 an hour. That's inadequate for the United States.
Exactly.
We'll have to compete with a country that has a minimum wage 25 cents an hour and runs roughshod over human rights, workers' rights. The Workers' Rights Consortium says that labor organizers in Vietnam are, it's much more difficult to organize independent labor unions and advocate for labor rights in Vietnam than in China.
Wow.
It's that bad.
Oh,
we're including Vietnam in this agreement to give them the benefit of access to our country and, you know, no tariffs, and we're basically rewarding them for bad behavior.
But here's the thing. I mean, at some point, you know, don't we as voters, don't we as taxpayers, as workers, as citizens of this country, you know, haven't we seen from NAFTA that these free trade schemes that they keep hoisting upon us that benefit these big multinational, not even your local mom and pop businesses, not even your community business, not them. They're the ones who are going to get hurt most by this. But these huge multinationals who these agreements are tailored for, haven't we figured out that it's destructive for we the people, but really good for they the corporation?
Well, I sure hope so. The politicians and the corporations keep making the same promises over and over and over that they break over and over. The NAFTA and allowing China into the World Trade Organization, which the U.S. supported and pushed for and got, that cost us 3.4 million jobs in the U.S. and Pennsylvania alone lost 130,000 jobs just because of these two deals. And that's a net. So exports, if we have increased exports, that increases jobs. If we have increased imports, that decreases jobs. We've had a vast expansion in our trade deficit, and Pennsylvania has lost 130,000 jobs just because of two trade deals.
Wow.
You imagine how much better it would be in Pennsylvania with 130,000 more mainly manufacturing jobs?
Yeah, I mean, and it's something I talk about all the time. You know, I hear my Tea Party friends screaming about the debt. Oh, the debt's so huge! And I said, yeah, we have debt problems because we keep sending money to places like China and all of these other countries that we have massive trade deficits with. Look, I'm concerned about the deficits and the debt, but I'm super concerned about our trade deficit because if you add the numbers up, just doing simple second-grade math, It's kind of spot on. All of our trade deficits seems to be almost the same number as our budget deficits and our debt.
Right. It's a direct relationship between our trade deficit and our budget deficit. If we reduce our trade deficit, we automatically reduce our budget deficit. And our overall trade deficit is around $550 billion last year. 2013.
Yep.
That would if we had balanced trade and increased our exports to match our imports or however you want to do it, that would mean 3 million additional jobs in the U.S. But because of these trade deals, like you mentioned, our trade deficit is almost guaranteed. These trade deals lead to increased deficits. They lead to fewer jobs, more job offshoring. And you'll hear the promises. They'll always say, they'll just focus on, well, it'll increase our exports. Pennsylvania workers will benefit from increasing exports. That's true. But they only tell half the story.
Right.
They don't tell the other part, which is
we're gonna be
larger
flooding.
Increases in imports
yep.
destroy jobs. And that's what they purposely leave out of the equation. They will not talk about imports. They won't talk about the job destruction of imports. And our imports are much higher than our exports, therefore we lose jobs. And it drives down our wages. But these agreements are even worse than jobs and wages. They're economic integration agreements. So your corporation, your multinational, you have a global supply chain of your production facilities are in all sorts of different countries, and your markets are in all sorts of different countries. You want, as a corporate executive, not that I've ever been a corporate executive, nor aspire to be one, but if you're in that position, you want to have one set of rules for all, so you don't have to go through all these different
right.
Hoops. And they want one set, but they want it at the lowest common denominator. So all the rules and regulations that protect our food, our drug prices, our environment, workers, are subject to this pressure, this race to the bottom. And in food, for example, you like seafood? Vietnam is the fifth largest supplier of shrimp to the U.S. Malaysia is a major supplier of shrimp to the U.S. The Food and Drug Administration only inspects 1 to 2% of food imports. The TPP will increase exports to the United States of food, our imports, significantly, so that the FDA will not be able to keep up and more tainted food will be coming into the U.S. Vietnam, 200 shipments of food, seafood, have been impounded because of the presence of E. coli, salmonella, and drug residues, some of which are carcinogenic. And we just don't have the ability to inspect all of it. And another part of the TPP that we've seen in this agreement is that it's called equivalence, so that another country can say they're equivalent to the U.S. and promise to implement our standards, basically,
right,
the common standards. But they can't do it. Yeah. We can't even do it here, but they can't do it there. But we're going to rely on them to inspect their food to meet standards.
Yeah, I mean, this agreement, everything I hear about it is bad. But, you know, the message we keep hearing, Ken, is, you know, we live in a global society. It's a global world, a global economy. You know, we've got to do these things. And, you know, we've got to, the only way it's going to pass is this fast track. And I look at, you know, you're the smart guy here. We've had trade policy for a couple hundred years, and it's just been the last couple of decades that we've gone after this fast track authority to usurp Congress's authority. How did we used to do trade? I mean, it seemed fairly balanced at one point or another. How did we used to do things compared to how we do them now?
Well, just like the structure of unions, I mean, of corporations has changed. So as the structure of these trade agreements. Before, for most of our history, trade agreements were about one thing, and that was tariffs, how much taxes we placed on goods coming into the country and how much taxes the other country would place on our goods. And it was all about that until really the early mid 70s with Nixon, and these agreements started to be more economic integration agreements. And it expanded the scope of these agreements, not just to tariffs, but to all these other things like patents and copyright and labor standards, environmental standards, and food safety standards, and intellectual property, and rules of origin. All this, these are integration agreements. And Nixon wanted to get a fast one by Congress and say, look, and this was largely tariff-based, but some other stuff. Just let's get it quickly through the tariff stuff. Let's just grease the skid. And that started then. But it really picked up with NAFTA. That was the first major economic integration agreement we had. Fast Track was used for that. And I'm sure you remember a major battle over that agreement. And now these agreements are much bigger. So now instead of just Canada, Mexico, and U.S., we've got 8-9 other countries. 38% of the world economic activity, and it's total economic integration. And this basically is legislation. And what Fast Track says is there will be, and a Fast Track bill was introduced, as I mentioned before, in the Senate and House, and they basically say there will be no amendments to the trade agreement.
So it's basically take it or leave it.
Take it or leave it, but what are we taking? And what we're taking is an agreement negotiated by the administration with the input largely of corporations, meeting the needs of corporations. And a leak of another document just this week was environmental chapter, which showed that the U.S. is stepping back from other agreements we had made. The Obama administration and the Bush administration beforehand promised that they would set a high standard for environmental standards in these trade agreements, and that they would be subject to other, what they call multilateral agreements on the environment. And what we saw from this leak just this week was the U.S. was stepping back. And this was a major black eye for the administration. And it has caused a lot of turmoil in the House and Senate.
As it should. I mean, this was a guy I voted for. I'll be honest. The sole reason I voted for this president was based on we're gonna renegotiate NAFTA, I sat 20 feet from him, and he said, "You can trust me. I'm not going to vote for Colombia. I'm not going to vote for Panama and the South Korean." And bang, here we got Panama, Colombia, South Korea, and now this. And no looking back at how horrible NAFTA was. We're just looking to replicate and even make worse what NAFTA was, if that's what I'm hearing from you.
Absolutely, and the scope is even larger.
So let me ask you this then. You know, because that jobs thing keeps coming up. And I saw a report by the folks at the Center for Economic and Policy Research who said that the gains from this would be absolutely minuscule, about 0.1% of our GDP. And they also go on to say that it could increase inequality and affect as many as 90% of the American workforce through decreased wages and lower standard of living. And I go, if that's the case, why would anybody even consider this?
And it's quite a contradiction that the Obama administration, I don't want to dump on them, but in this case,
they deserve it, earned
that the president, supposedly, especially in the upcoming State of the Union address, will address inequality. And here, on the other hand, and he wants to do things about reducing inequality, but he's championing a trade agreement which will absolutely increase inequality in the U.S. and really around the world. So that's a contradiction, and we should support the president when he needs support.
Yep.
And where he warrants support, but oppose him on issues that are not good for the mass of people around the world, especially in the U.S. And it's even so bad that the intellectual property chapter, which was leaked, basically expands and extends the patent protection for the big pharmaceutical companies so that they can prevent and delay the development of generic drugs. So as a result, the AARP and Consumers Union have written letters. Consumers Union, also joined by AFSCME and other groups, paid for an ad stating that the TPP will not only increase prices for, which would increase costs for Medicare and Medicaid, but would also place a number of benefits from Medicare and Medicaid at risk.
Wow.
So the leaks that we have are show devastating. They would be devastating to seniors, working people, families here and across the world. Doctors Without Borders stated that the TPP is the worst trade pact ever in terms of access to affordable medicines in developing countries.
So let me ask you this, to wrap this up, how do we stop it? What should we be doing? What are the marching orders?
The marching orders are immediately sit down and call your member of Congress and say vote against the fast track bill in the House. I believe it's 3830. I have to look it up. But vote against the fast track bill. We defeated fast track in 1998. It passed in 2001 or two under Bush by just two votes. Almost 200 members of Congress have already written letters and made statements opposing fast track. So we have a good base. We have a real possibility of defeating this thing. If we defeat fast track, it'll be very hard for the TPP to recover.
And that's the goal.
If they pass fast track, it'll be very hard to defeat TPP. So now is the moment to talk to your friends. You can go to our website, www.stopthetpp.org. You can find flyers, fact sheets. Yesterday, our president, CWA President Larry Cohen, testified before the Senate Finance Committee about fast track and the TPP. There were four witnesses. Three of them were business people who were in favor of fast track and the TPP. The person chosen to represent working people was Larry Cohen, and he also talked about the impacts of the fast track and TPP on the environment and on consumers. So this is an issue that everyone should be concerned about. Even the Tea Party.
Absolutely.
Has issued a statement. A whole coalition of Tea Parties have issued a statement saying that the TPP and fast track was not only ceding constitutional authority to the president, but was also undermining U.S. sovereignty. And that is That is correct.
All right.
So
the website,
wherever you are on the ideological spectrum, you should support improving. We're not against trade. And as you mentioned before, this is a globalized world. We're in favor of trade that is fair trade and that will lift people up, that will raise standards, that will improve our conditions of work for our families, our quality of life. We oppose free trade agreements that would only benefit the 1% at the expense of everyone else. So don't let anyone say, oh, you're against trade. No, we're against trade that is unequal, that only benefits 1%. We're for trade that benefits everybody.
There you go. Again, the website, stopthetpp.org. We'll get a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Dr. Ken Paris's name. It'll take you right there. Ken, I appreciate you taking time for us. And as this fight continues, we'd love to have you back again. Thanks so much.
Rick, thank you, and hello to everyone in Pennsylvania. My mother-in-law, who's a nice person, is from Wilkes-Barre area.
Oh, good.
Enjoy Pennsylvania, especially in the springtime and fall, and do the right thing.
There you go. Thanks so much, Ken. Appreciate it. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425. You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The National Labor Relations Board complained against Walmart this week as the board's largest ever complaint against an employer. It alleges that Walmart illegally fired and disciplined workers for using their legal rights to speak out for better jobs in 14 states at 34 stores. The NLRB says Walmart broke federal labor law, violating workers' rights by retaliating against them for job actions, strikes, and protests aimed at improving their jobs. 63 store managers are named, as well as a Walmart spokesman and vice president of communications, accused of being responsible for illegal threats against workers. Barbara Collins was fired by the company. She says Walmart workers have a right to speak out and won't be silenced. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers had very different Walmart news on Thursday. They announced an agreement with Walmart to join the Fair Food Program to benefit farm workers. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers said Walmart agreed to work with the workers' organization and Walmart's Florida tomato suppliers to strengthen and expand the Fair Food Program. The program gets companies to pay a small increase in the price they pay for tomatoes to concretely and directly benefit farm workers. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers is working to improve working conditions and pay in the fields, and says it's pleased to welcome Walmart into the Fair Food Program. Michigan's appeals court this week upheld a 2012 law that cut pensions for public school employees by requiring them to put more of their wages into the pension system. Michigan's American Federation of Teachers had challenged the constitutionality of the law. The law imposed what amounts to a $15 billion pensions cut on the public school workers. Despite that huge hit on their pensions, the court ruled it did not violate Michigan's constitutional ban on diminishing public worker pensions. The court said it didn't diminish current vested pension benefits, just future benefits. That same law eliminated employer-provided health care for new hires in Michigan public schools. 30 workers at a Delaware Amazon warehouse voted against joining the International Association of Machinists. That vote was 21-6 against union representation. The IAM said Amazon worked behind the scenes to turn workers against the union. The union said workers faced intense pressures from managers and anti-union consultants hired to suppress the organizing drive. But IAM Eastern District spokesman John Carr says the IAM won't give up on organizing Amazon workers. Unions in Los Angeles are promoting a $15 minimum wage. The Los Angeles City Council is expected to introduce a minimum wage ordinance soon. Unions in L.A. released a report this week from the Economic Roundtable that says more than 810,000 residents of Los Angeles make less than $15 an hour. The unions have put up city limits billboards downtown on the city's west side and near the airport. They say, Los Angeles, city limited,
Poverty wage population, 810,864. The Economic Roundtable report says that 46% of workers in Los Angeles make less than $15 an hour, and a citywide raise to $15 would be enough economic stimulus to create 67,400 new jobs in Los Angeles County.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
And I got to tell you, you know, you look at the all the rhetoric about, oh, we believe in family values and we love the children. Oh, we so love the children. And, you know, we love the poor. Now, how much rhetoric have we heard the last couple of weeks about how much the Republicans just love poor people and, oh, they just want to help. Yet everything policy-wise they do only seems to make poverty all that much worse and that much more difficult for the folks who are living in poverty. And one of the biggest disgraces to me was the holiday season. You know, our millionaire clubs in Congress, they decided, hey, it's time to go home. Little vacation for us. Well-deserved holiday of doing well, nothing. But those unemployed folks, screw you. I mean, that was really a lump of coal, nothing. They got a big you-know-what, which is why we've asked our good friend Isaiah Poole from the Campaign for America's Future to come talk to us on Our Future Friday. What should we be doing? Where should we be going? Isaiah, thanks for taking time for us.
I very much appreciate it.
So I look at this, you know, and I remember, you know, I was on vacation like our members of Congress, but it wasn't my job to make sure that policies were in place to help the least among us.
Right, and this week, Congress has gone on a one-week recess, and not only have they kicked jobless people once, but they've actually kicked jobless people twice. A lot of us have been talking about the unemployment insurance benefits for the long-term unemployed, and the fact that those were cut off on December 28th for people who have been unemployed for more than 26 weeks. These were the emergency jobless benefits that were put in place after the recession to help people who needed more time to find a job in this economy. Congress left, basically sent the Senate Republicans filibustered an effort by the Democrats to try to get something that would get these benefits reinstated. But what they did do was pass a 2014 budget. And people have been saying, great, they finally, Republicans and Democrats, finally came together on a budget. But the problem with that budget, given that our number one crisis is unemployment, that budget contains virtually nothing to address the problems of joblessness in this country. It contains no money to ramp up infrastructure spending or public service jobs or any of the kinds of things that we need to get more people back into work and get the economy moving again.
It seemed to me the budget was it seemed to me very simply the budget was just this is the bare minimum that we could both parties could hold their nose and vote for, just so they would have the appearance that they were actually doing some work together and that maybe things aren't as bad as everyone thinks. But as you pointed out, there's really no visionary leadership here, no look to the future, no how do we fix the crisis we're in. And we've been in this jobs crisis since 2008. Even into 2007, we've been in this jobs crisis, and still our Congress has done nothing.
Congress has done nothing. And, in fact, if you read that, the House summaries of the bill that was passed, it's actually quite disdainful of rational things that we should be doing. It says that, you know, in boldface, that we are not spending any money on high-speed rail, as if not spending money on high-speed rail is a good thing. Actually, I think not spending money on high-speed rail is a bad thing.
I agree.
Because that's something that we can do to dramatically improve our transportation network, take a load off of our airlines, and have a much more inefficient, energy-efficient way of moving people around. It mocks the idea of spending money on green projects and says and proudly points out that there are there's no new money for green or livable or sustainable development projects. Also, actually, when you think about it, a very bad thing, because the United States really needs to take a lead in developing green and sustainable projects of all kinds. So, I mean, I think there are some flat-out insults in here, and I'm actually quite surprised that as many Democrats voted for this as they did. I think it would have been very good if more Democrats had stood up and said, no, we are not going to accept this, and make the case for why this was unacceptable.
And again, it comes back down to, I think, what you pointed out, that there's no look towards the future in this. And that's what's infuriating to me. We've got such tip-of-the-nose politicians. We don't have statesmen anymore. We've got people who are legislating by poll. You know, what's the poll today? Let me put my finger in the wind. And we're not seeing that visionary leadership that's what's this country going to look like in 5, 10, 20 years? To me, that's the most disturbing thing. And not so much that I know they're not going to fix today's problems, but thinking about tomorrow, you know, investing in the future seems to be a no-brainer in my view.
And we are making a point of not investing in the future. The president had put forth a universal preschool proposal. That is not funded in this 2014 budget. So that's another example of something where we're shortchanging the future in order to actually shortchange the present, because we're not doing any favors for the present either by cutting back on these things. We have been subjected to this argument and dominated by this argument, as you know, that the federal deficit is our number one problem. The federal deficit, in fact, has been declining much more rapidly than it has since the end of World War II. And we will never solve our long-term fiscal problem until we substantially grow the economy.
Yep. And
so
we
substantially growing the economy has got to be the number one priority.
I'm right there with you. And also with growing the economy is leveling out our insane trade deficits. Because while you may be concerned about budget deficits, I think the trade deficits are a much more telling tale of our economic woes. The fact that we're sending money out of this country and bringing cheap products in from overseas, and that not having that manufacturing base that reverberates throughout the economy, to me, that should be a mission number one. How do we solve our trade problems, Isaiah? Not by passing more NAFTA-like trade agreements like this insane Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement, which now we're seeing them asking for fast-track authority, which, you know, to me is just dumb on so many levels.
It's dumb on so many levels. The good news is that Democrats are beginning to resist it, and the bills that were put forth on fast track in the Senate or in the House are not getting Democratic co-sponsors. And so I think there is going to be some real panic, I think, over in the White House, and for good reason, because as you say, we need to rebuild our manufacturing base. We need to create jobs in that sector. We cannot afford to sign another trade agreement that will have the effect of hemorrhaging jobs overseas. We just cannot afford that anymore. Not only will the Trans-Pacific Partnership not serve the United States, but also won't serve these other countries in Asia and Mexico, because a lot of what has happened when corporations have been allowed to run roughshod over those economies have not served them well either. And so we need a trade agreement that protect our economic interests and also protect the economic and environmental interests of those countries as well.
You know, as I look down the road, I see so many opportunities, Isaiah, so many things that we should be looking for. And, you know, one of the things I want people to walk away from our conversations on this segment is, you know, where are we going? What should we be looking for? And one of the things that I think is so important is, you know, you pointed out the Republicans are proud of the fact no universal pre-K. I think that should be almost one of the very first things we should be pushing for if we're looking for the future. Make sure that education is there from the very beginning of life so we can have a more educated workforce, because they keep telling us that those are the jobs of the future. And I don't know if you've been paying attention to some of the stories here lately about how in 20 years, about half of the jobs we have today will be mechanized, and we're going to have an even more educated workforce to keep up. To me, it just says, you know, education right now more than ever, yet you look at states across this country, here in Pennsylvania, massive cuts to education.
And the irony of this is that if you're concerned about poverty and the effects of poverty on learning and on development, one of the things that we're learning is that a good preschool levels out, helps to level out anyway, the effects of poverty on education. So that if you have a kid who's gone through a period of preschool before he gets into that elementary grade, he's better able to keep up as he goes through elementary school, even if he comes from a poor family. So I think it's something that we've just got to fight for. We have something called the Education Opportunity Network, and it's run by a guy named Jeff Bryan, who, if you want to see his work, go to educationopportunitynetwork.org. He writes about things like preschool education and, in fact, what our education agenda ought to be going forward. It's must-read stuff if you care about education.
So you mean, education policy shouldn't be based basically on attacking teachers and looking for the cheapest wage that we can get for teachers, and then eventually mechanizing them? That's not the way we should be going?
That's not the way we should be going at all. The high-stakes testing, you know, the privatization of schools, none of this. There is an agenda of supporting public education, making sure that public education is, in fact, public, valuing teachers and empowering teachers to do their best work, and putting money into the classroom and not in these privatization schemes, which in many cases have blown up in our faces. We have a major charter scandal school right here in Washington, D.C. right now that involves millions of dollars being siphoned out of the classroom into the pockets of some charter school executives. It's crazy. It's the kind of thing that would never have happened in a public school situation.
And that's one of the things that really bothers me. I mean, you talk about being fiscally conservative. You look at all the money that has been wasted on this scheme of privatization of our education. It's maddening.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, so what one of the things that I hope that people will do when now that Congress is in, members of Congress are in the states and in the congressional districts this week, what we've been saying is number one, this unemployment insurance thing is unacceptable. When you come back to Washington, make that the first order of business. And do not say that other poor programs that also support struggling families need to be cut to pay for benefits for the unemployed. We can afford, as a country, $6.5 billion to pay for 3 months of unemployment benefits, people from being tossed out of their home. I talked to a woman yesterday, lost her home, now in a homeless shelter. She's selling her clothes.
Wow.
In order to get food to eat.
And the thing is, why, Isaiah, that could be any one of us at any time. That
exactly.
Could be one illness, one job loss. How many of us are that close to that situation?
Absolutely. So, I mean, we shouldn't be allowing that sort of thing. So I would say to you, member of Congress, just pass the UI bill, first of all. And then let's start working on these things like preschool, universal preschool. Let's work on making sure that we are not tying ourselves to yet another bad trade deal. Let's put money back into the economy. Let's find ways to use the government resources, first of all, to put people back to work, doing the things that we need to do. There's a lot of work that we should be doing to shore up the economy.
Absolutely.
And enable the private sector to then build upon that. This is what we've always done. You know, government back in the 1950s, government built the interstate highway system. The private sector was able to use that to create one of the greatest economic expansions we've had. The internet was a government investment that the private sector was able to leverage and build upon.
And now going to be able to control, thanks to the D.C. Appeals Court.
But you get my point.
Yep. No, but I mean, I get your point, but what the conservatives would say and what the folks who claim to be fiscally responsible would say is that, Isaiah, we're just broke. We don't have the money. Sorry. You know, those were wonderful things back then. You know, we had money. We were flush in cash. We had a tax, back in the 50s, we had a top marginal tax rate of 92%. So, of course, we had money to spend. We just don't have
it
anymore.
And we had a top marginal tax rate of 92%. You know, part of the problem is that we have allowed corporations to park most of its profits overseas.
Yep.
We have allowed corporations to create all sorts of elaborate tax dodges. And, you know, even when they do pay taxes, they pay taxes at a lower rate than they ever have historically. So, and you cannot have, thanks to the Republicans, you cannot have a rational conversation about tax reform. That's they're doing. So what we, you know, there's a lot of money slashing around, something like about $2 trillion, by the way, just, you know, banks are just sort of sitting on because they can.
Yeah.
And because, to be honest, they don't see the economy being vibrant enough yet to jump in and make a lot of investment. So that's why we need several things to come together. We need federal government to pump money into the economy, to pump money into people's pockets and get people back to work. We need banks to step up and take all of that money that the Federal Reserve gave them and put that money back in the economy. And maybe what we need to do is say to the banks, if you're not going to put the money into the economy, we're going to tax it.
There you go. If you're not going to use it, we'll make sure it gets used. So the marching orders right now, to wrap this up, contact your member of Congress, pass the UI bill, pass the unemployment insurance bill, and let's not keep beating up on poor people. Stop that.
Stop that.
Stop it. Do your job. Isaiah, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time. Look forward to our segment next week on Our Future Friday. Thanks so much.
All right. Take care.
Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Coleman Lowndes. This week, the Senate released the results of its investigation into the 2012 Benghazi attacks. The bipartisan report dispelled many of Fox News' favorite conspiracy theories surrounding the attacks, including the myth that the Obama administration engaged in some sort of cover-up of the attacks. Yet Fox host Bill O'Reilly continued to push these myths, peppering guest James Carville with questions about the origins of Susan Rice's suggestion that the attacks may have originated from a protest over an anti-Islamic film. Listen to Carville attempt to explain that the Senate report answered O'Reilly's question.
As Director Petraeus said, and as the committee said, that was consistent with what the intelligence community was saying.
No, that's not what Panetta said.
You look at the report,
opposite.
And that's what they said.
I don't care about that. Care about the bloody report. You don't know the answer to that question tonight.
Why are you covering the report if you don't care about it?
Fox News' heavy coverage of the Senate report has consistently ignored the facts in the report in order to smear the administration's response. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Who says the economy is down and that consumers aren't willing to spend in order to stimulate new economic growth? The problem with gloomy economists and skittish policymakers is that they don't know where to look for signs that boom times are back, baby. For example, take auto sales. Yeah, overall, they're putzing along at a moderate to low pace, but open your eyes, people. Do you not see that Maserati sales were up 55% last year? Or that Rolls-Royce, Lamborghini, Porsche, and Bentley also produced double-digit increases? Listen to Matt Lavin, a Cleveland high roller who told the New York Times that he bought three Mercedes last year. One for $237,000, another for $165,000, and an auxiliary $97,000 number for his wife. Extravagant? It's all a matter of perspective. I look at it as I don't have a boat, Matt explains. There you go. Economics is all about having a positive attitude. So, with a booming stock market, high-tech wealth bubbling like crazy, and Fortune 500 CEOs making big bales of hay while the sun shines, what's not to like about America's economic future? An automotive lifestyle consultant told The Times, luxury is not a dirty word anymore. Now, isn't that a telling insight? You see, when Wall Street crashed 6 years ago, then got bailed out by Washington while the middle class sank, many of your one percenters and higher got squeamish about living the luxurious life they deserve. But that's not the American way. Hey, if you've got it, flaunt it. This is Jim Hightower saying, surely we can all see the social value of top-end buyers who are willing to step up and make big-ticket purchases again. By leading the consumer charge, these bold luxury buyers are providing a role model that your lower classes need to do their own part in reviving America's economy.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Fuzzy math. It's fuzzy math. Fuzzy math. I'm practicing fuzzy math. So a lot of times we need to fudge the numbers and not tell the truth. For diplomacy to be effective, lies must be credible.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Wow, what was that? Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. So the folks at Progress, Missouri, came up with this clip of the state senator and the co-chair of the American Legislative Exchange Council, a guy named Ed Emery. And Ed was very candid. Ed was very honest. You got to give him credit. They now feel emboldened to tell the truth. He was asked about right to work and what it meant. And he said, well, one of the things that will be advocated by unions is look at all of these right to work states. Average wages all go down. Sure they do, he said. You have a whole lot more people working in those states. And they aren't necessarily working for $25 an hour. They couldn't get a job for $25, but they can get a job for $20 because they're worth $20. They couldn't get a job for, or they're 17 or 12. He says, so all of a sudden, you have a whole lot more people working. But you won't find in any of those states that the workers who are employed, unionized, that their wages have gone down. You'll find that there's more people working because there's more freedom. The employer has more freedom, and the worker has more freedom. He says, as we go forward in Missouri with promoting freedom to work, we need to be sure that people understand the difference between liberty and oppression. So am I hearing this right? Am I hearing, because I've been saying for a long time, labor really needs to go back and claim right to work for their own. And say, look, we should have a right to work. We should have the rights to work. There should be a job. There should be something there. We should have a right to a job. And they should come with benefits, health care, and retirement, and a decent wage. I've been saying that for a while. And now I think the right is trying to find some alternative language as people realize that the right to work schemes that are being thrown at us are just that, BS, schemes, nonsense. And as we realize there are no rights, there's no work, they've got to change the language. Much like, you know, they did here in the state of Pennsylvania with privatizing the liquor store. First it was about the money. We're going to make billions of dollars. And then it was about, oh, it's a core function of government. So it's interesting to me. I'm I think we should be paying attention to this for a while to see how often Republicans now use freedom to work. I love that. You got to love the language. It's liberty and oppression. Making a decent wage, making a good wage with health care and retirement. That's oppression, I'm telling you. I should have the freedom to starve. I should have the freedom to work for peanuts. And the boss should have the freedom to screw me. And the reality is when I listen to this statement, and the audio was horrible, or I would have played it for you. When I listen to him say this, now understand what he said. He admitted wages go down. They know that inexplicitly. Wages go down. Benefits go away. Zach Womp, the congressman from Tennessee, I play the clip all the time. Lower wages, less health care. That's what right to work means. That's what it's about. We know that. Or at least I hope we do. But what he said that caught my attention, because he fully admitted, sure, the wages go down. That's a given. But what he said is, well, you know, a lot more people are working. And he started going down the wages. Wages will go down, yes, but we've got more people working. And it used to be, you know, a basic economic theory that they used to promote. The more people work, the tighter the labor pool, the higher the wages go up, right? He's completely walking away from that theory. It's something they've always pushed. Because he knows in places where you don't have the ability to negotiate, the wages don't go up. It's that simple. And you go back and you look at study after study, EPI, the Economic Policy Institute, they, in their 2011, said that the evidence is overwhelming that right-to-work laws have not succeeded in boosting employment growth in the states that have adopted them. Hofstra University, a professor there, found in 2007 that employment was actually lower in states with right-to-work laws when they controlled for other factors. And in 2011, a study done by a couple of professors at the University of Nevada found that that there was no evidence to support right-to-work laws increased employment in manufacturing and in Idaho or Oklahoma. What we do know, beyond exception, is the states that have these so-called right-to-work laws, higher poverty rates, higher percentages of food insecurity, lower opportunities for economic mobility. If you're in a poverty class, you're going to stay there. There's no moving up the economic ladder. Lower health insurance rates, lower pension rates. Is that what we want for Pennsylvania? You got to ask yourself that. Even if you're not a member of a union, understand downward pressure means downward for everyone. It's that simple. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The National Labor Relations Board complaint against Walmart this week is the board's largest ever complaint against an employer. It alleges that Walmart illegally fired and disciplined workers for using their legal rights to speak out for better jobs in 14 states at 34 stores. The NLRB says Walmart broke federal labor law, violating workers' rights by retaliating against them for job actions, strikes, and protests aimed at improving their jobs. 63 store managers are named, as well as a Walmart spokesman and vice president of communications, accused of being responsible for illegal threats against workers. Barbara Collins was fired by the company. She says Walmart workers have a right to speak out and won't be silenced. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers had very different Walmart news on Thursday. They announced an agreement with Walmart to join the Fair Food Program to benefit farm workers. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers said Walmart agreed to work with the workers' organization and Walmart's Florida tomato suppliers to strengthen and expand the Fair Food Program. The program gets companies to pay a small increase in the price they pay for tomatoes to concretely and directly benefit farm workers. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers is working to improve working conditions and pay in the fields and says it's pleased to welcome Walmart into the Fair Food Program. Michigan's appeals court this week upheld a 2012 law that cut pensions for public school employees by requiring them to put more of their wages into the pension system. Michigan's American Federation of Teachers had challenged the constitutionality of the law. The law imposed what amounts to a $15 billion pensions cut on the public school workers. Despite that huge hit on their pensions, the court ruled it did not violate Michigan's constitutional ban on diminishing public worker pensions. The court said it didn't diminish current vested pension benefits, just future benefits. That same law eliminated employer-provided health care for new hires in Michigan public schools. 30 workers at a Delaware Amazon warehouse voted against joining the International Association of Machinists. That vote was 21-6 against union representation. The IAM said Amazon worked behind the scenes to turn workers against the union. The union said workers faced intense pressures from managers and anti-union consultants hired to suppress the organizing drive. But IAM Eastern District spokesman John Carr says the IAM won't give up on organizing Amazon workers. Unions in Los Angeles are promoting a $15 minimum wage. The Los Angeles City Council is expected to introduce a minimum wage ordinance soon. Unions in L.A. released a report this week from the Economic Roundtable that says more than 810,000 residents of Los Angeles make less than $15 an hour. The unions have put up city limits billboards downtown on the city's west side and near the airport. They say Los Angeles, city limited. Poverty wage population, 810,864. The Economic Roundtable report says that 46% of workers in Los Angeles make less than $15 an hour, and a citywide raise to $15 would be enough economic stimulus to create 67,400 new jobs in Los Angeles County.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. So Obama gave the big speech today, and you know what? I saw none of it. Completely out of the loop, focused entirely on, well, of course, the big news of the day that we talked about already, the voter ID undone. And good for you, Mike Terzai. But, you know, again, I spent most of my time on that, so I got to find out what happened today, and that's why we've got Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much.
Completely, the speech on the NSA, completely off my radar today.
Yeah, well, you've got big news
that,
in your state.
That's huge news.
I can understand that. Huge.
I mean, today, our governor, bad day. First, he bails on a bunch of kids that he was supposed to go and accept some kind of reward or get some recognition for. He bails on them. Then there's a shooting at a Philly charter school. And then this, the voter suppression law, unconstitutional. I mean, you stop and think of all the things this guy's done. Act 13, unconstitutional. The gerrymandering, unconstitutional. This, unconstitutional. You go down the list, you go, how many strikes do you get in the baseball game? At this point, he's out.
Yeah. Now, they're going to appeal that, right?
Of course they're going to appeal it.
Right.
Yeah. And that's where you get into the interesting, you've got another Republican court. So where does it go from there? I mean, to me, it's very much common sense. When you put these roadblocks between people and their right to the franchise, their right to cast their ballot, it's only for one reason, and that's to suppress the vote. And as Tom Corbett said in 2010, as Corbett, the candidate Corbett, if we could just suppress the vote, hold the vote down in Philadelphia, we'll do well. That's the game plan.
It's a clue. Well, a statement like that does seem to be a clue.
Yeah, and when you got the chairman of the Republican Party here, Gillespie, saying that, well, you know, voter ID, If you look at the two elections for President Obama, he beat McCain by 10%, only beat Romney by 5%. Voter ID had something to do with it, I guess, maybe. He wanted to say it had everything to do with it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I thought it was a fascinating ruling. And I think there was an element of arbitrariness to, you know, that, okay, you can do a provisional vote, but you have to come back within, what is it, 6 days?
Yeah.
With the requisite number of bits of ID. So that's arbitrary. Why 6 days?
And the thing that gets me is these are people who have already jumped through the legal hoops of the time to get their voter registration card. I can almost, on a certain level, say, okay, these people are grandfathered in. If you were registered to vote before a certain part of the time, you're in. But that's not how they even tried to sneak it through. They just said, on this day, if you don't have it, the heck with you, you're out.
So what happens, what effect does it have in terms of what happens in the November election?
Well, as has gone on in the last couple of elections, they will ask you for your ID, and you tell them, I'm not showing it to you, I don't have it, and then they let you vote anyway. Now, to me, you know, this last election, the Commonwealth spent $1 million advertising that you needed an ID. But, you know, it's just in the future. And, you know, you think of all the money that they've spent, you know, throwing this out there and all the money they've spent with billboards and bus ads and you name it. It seems like an enormous waste of money to me on so many levels. But look at it in the context that it's not even the law yet. And that's just mind-blowing. And here's the part that just gets me. What they passed and what was found unconstitutional, even the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania says they have never found a case, they have never prosecuted a case, they don't know of any case, they have nothing of this law ever stopping anything, yet we have to have it.
Amazing.
I mean, it's right there in black and white in the stipulation of facts. The Commonwealth stipulated right from the beginning. We don't know of anything, nothing in the nation. We don't know of anything. There's nothing ongoing, but we still want it. And I look at other states like Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas that have all done similar things like this, and it looks like, you know, there's some key portions of the Voting Rights Act that may be coming back in those states because, you know, I think it's painfully apparent. The goal is to suppress the vote and keep those people from voting.
Well, I mean, there are some states that they are going to attempt to put under the Voting Rights Act, under this new bipartisan Voting Rights Act that they're reintroducing.
Any chance of it getting through?
Well, it's a bipartisan bill. It doesn't have a lot of Republicans on board yet. And it's being introduced simultaneously in the House and the Senate. I think it's going to be tough to get it through the House, but it's got Sensenbrenner. Eric Cantor hasn't said which way he's leaning, but if it gets his support, it could start to get some more support. And he has been supportive of reintroducing the Voting Rights Act.
Interesting. So maybe there's a shot. Who knows? But since I've been focused on the voter ID all day, what happened with Obama's speech? What are the new ideas? Are our phones going to be safe? Are they Big Brother listening? What's going on?
Yes, he is. And he's not going to stop. That's one thing that the president's not going to change. He's going to keep on listening. But there are going to be some tweaks.
Okay.
So, and that's something that, by the way, that Rand Paul was not, Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky was not the least bit impressed with, that there are going to be tweaks. He was saying that he didn't care where the metadata is going to be stored. He's objecting to it being collected in the first place. But the big discussion was about, well, where is it going to be stored? Is it going to be stored at the NSA? Is it going to be stored in a private place? And it's looking more like it's going to be stored in a private place. But the president was saying that he's leaving it up to Eric Holder to liaise on that with the intelligence communities and lawmakers to liaise on that one. Also, another thing that he's going to do is at the moment, if they want to get info about you, it can be as far away as three hops, it's known as. So, I speak to you, and then they can go the next person you call, and everybody they talk to, and then everybody they talk to, everybody they talk to. Yes, that's three hops.
That's a fairly wide net, because I could call for pizza.
And then it's everybody on that list, and everybody they talk to, that's a hop. They're changing it to two hops.
Okay.
Rather than three.
Wow.
And apparently the intelligence community isn't really objecting to that, partly because there's so much work involved in doing three hops that it just didn't seem to make an awful lot of sense.
So let me ask you this. Have they gotten anything out of this? I mean, I guess if you throw a net wide enough, eventually you catch something. I mean, you know, even I, who am not a fisherman, even eventually if I keep my line in the water long enough, something's got to be dumb enough to come by and bite, right?
Well, you know, there was one point I was in the basement of the White House, and I had the transcript up, and I was listening, and I was tweeting, and there was at one point at which President Obama said, he cited a case where one of the 9/11 hijackers made a phone call, an overseas phone call, that the NSA had the phone call, but that if they'd had access to such and such a program, they could have done this with the phone call and this and this, or they possibly could have done this. And I'm reading the transcript and thinking, he's trying to say that they could have stopped the 9/11 attacks with the bulk data program. But he's not actually saying it,
right?
Because he can't say that because it's not true. But he's coming as close as up to the line saying it. And that hasn't been widely reported, but he said that. That is exactly what he said. But he didn't say it, and he did not cite in what was an over a 30-minute speech, he did not cite one specific instance of, okay, Rick Scott did this, and this, and we caught him because of this data program or that data program or this. He didn't give one example.
Because I don't know that there is. I'm sure there's got to be something. And maybe, possibly, in his, if I have to defend him, maybe they don't want to give up that kind of intelligence and actually say if they did ever catch anything. I don't know, but I'm uncomfortable with the idea of it being held so secretive, and you know, not even our representatives know. I understand you need to have some classified information, but there's got to be somebody overseeing that classified stuff.
Well, it seems that there's two programs. There's the 215 program, which is this bulk collection of records where Verizon and these other phone companies, you don't know who they are, collect our phone records. Or they collect, you know, they collect our phone records. And that, his own privacy, his own review panel, said that it hadn't been useful. And lawmakers have said, who've had access to classified stuff, have said it hasn't been useful. And, nobody has come forward and said that it's been useful. Nobody's come forward and said that it's been useful. And when DNI Clapper has been challenged on this, and Keith Alexander, the head of the CIA, has been challenged on this, where they have not been said that it's been useful. Then there's another program, the 702 program, which is the overseas program. Everybody concedes that that has been useful. And that's a different program. And even people like Ron Wyden and these other critics concede that that's a more effective program, and they don't fall for that one. That's not one that they're calling to have ended. But it's this collection of all our phone records that people are concerned about.
Well, there's always the don't use the phone, maybe. Maybe
there's always that.
We go to a... I don't know. Yeah, I look at this stuff, and all of it just seems so very Orwellian to me. And, you know, eventually, you know, our TVs are going to be spying on us, and we're going to have our 2 minutes hate and do our calisthenics in front of the TV.
That's a scary, scary thought.
I cannot believe how much I remember from that book. I read it back, I don't know, almost 30 years ago.
That's why it was so brilliant.
Yeah, it scared the hell out of me. And the sad thing is we're living most of it. I look at the Supreme Court now. They're weighing if police can search my cell phone now.
Yeah, it was. There were a couple of interesting cases. They've been. It wasn't certain whether they were going to take up these cases, and it's also not certain whether they're techie enough to understand them. But when is a cell phone not a cell phone? When is a cell phone just a box, or when is it a box with data? The cases arise from criminal prosecutions that used evidence obtained without a warrant. And they're going to look into how to apply older court precedent, which allows police to search items carried by a defendant at the time of arrest. And really the legal question is whether a search for this info after a defendant's arrested violates the Fourth Amendment, which bans contains unreasonable searches.
I think it does.
And, well, I do too. But it's going to rest on what the definition of a cell phone is and whether all that information inside your cell phone is private.
So if you were carrying around a laptop, how would it be any different?
Oh, that may not be different at all. That laptop information may be considered to be public, too. And the border searches, it is considered public.
Even if it's password protected?
Yes.
Wow, that's flat wrong. I mean, I'm in favor of you going in and getting a warrant. You want to see it? You got to have probable cause. I don't like this idea of fishing expeditions. It's supposed to be they have a warrant. They tell you exactly what they're looking for and where they're looking, and that's how they execute that warrant. I'm in favor of that. But this, you know, I'm going to stop you for a traffic violation, strip search, and body cavity, and cell phone. I'm not going there.
And they seem increasingly going there. This is going to be really, really interesting. I'm really looking forward to this one, and I'm very concerned that they're going to say that they can go there because. Searching a cell phone. I mean, you've got your phone. You've got emails in your cell phone. You've got really private stuff in there. But I've got stuff in there that I am not saying is public. I'm saying it is private.
Exactly. I mean, as our cell phones become more of our PCs. I mean, nowadays, you know, I know people who don't even have computers. They do everything on their phone. All of their business work, everything, and right from there. So. I'm not going there, but it'll be interesting. Let's move on to Ohio. I guess they're having some questions about the drugs they're using to execute people. Why don't they just do like, I think it was Wyoming?
It was Wyoming.
Going back to firing squads?
They're looking at it. There's a lawmaker who's recommending it. Part of the reason he's recommending it is because he says it's cheap.
Yeah.
Well, so he thinks that's a good plan. The problem they're having with execution is that the stuff that they like to use to put people to death with, the companies that make it don't want it to be used for killing people, and so they can't get hold of it anymore. That's the problem.
Because when I first heard that they couldn't get it, I go, are we killing that many people that they can't keep producing it?
No. It's that the company won't allow it to be used for death.
Well, can't we find another capitalist company that says, we'll be more than happy. We'll have Freedom Industries, who just filed bankruptcy, come out of bankruptcy and make killer chemicals, you know, like that Freedom Water that we saw spilling into West Virginia.
No, it comes from these damn Europeans who don't believe in the death penalty.
See, our heavy dependence on foreign production, that's the problem.
Yeah, namby-pamby Europeans. So we've decided to turn to compounding pharmacies and mixing our own chemicals ourselves.
Hmm.
And that's what ended up with a 25-minute death.
Now, how did Kevorkian do it?
He did it. I liked Kevorkian. He was an interesting man. He did it remarkably painlessly and quickly.
Yeah, I mean, can't we do that?
You would think, but
see,
I don't
now,
even
I'm...
know whether those... drugs are available.
See, here's the thing. I mean, and this is where I have a problem. I'm against the death penalty. Institutionally, I don't believe the state should be murdering people. Now, I do believe in vigilantism. I think, you know, like there's a case here in our area where these two idiots grabbed this girl, did all kinds of stuff, you know, stabbed it and lit her on fire and all of this stuff. I'm in favor of the family tearing the two of them to shreds because I believe in direct retribution, but not so much in the state way.
Well, there's something chillingly cold about it, and the judge who authorized this execution to go ahead, who had refused to allow a whole slew of executions to go ahead over several years, did at least say that the entire thing needed to be documented and that everything involved in the execution needed to be kept for future evidence.
Yeah.
So any lawsuit is going to have a plethora of evidence available to it.
Now we shall see. And lastly, Chris Christie is horrific?
This is interesting. Chris Christie has a very busy weekend fundraising for Rick Scott, the Florida governor, who's got a tough re-election campaign. And then he's got a big meeting. meeting on Sunday with over 100 Republican millionaires and billionaires. And one of the top fundraisers for former Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney called Christie horrific, according to a report today by the Miami Herald. He says, the guy as a person is horrific. This is Brian Ballard. He's a top Florida lobbyist and Romney's finance chair. He also said that 90% of other major Romney fundraisers outside of the New York metro region wouldn't touch Christie with a 10-foot pole right now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if he's the guy.
What Christie did to Obama isn't suitable to say in a family newspaper.
But here's the thing. He's the guy. They fund him. It's that simple.
Yeah.
It's that simple. Say what you want now. It's that simple. He's the guy that they're going to fund him. Victoria, I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Never you will look back again. You fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared.
Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Somebody during the break sent me an email saying, well, you know, people in Pennsylvania, they want this paycheck deception. They want it. And he sent me to a poll done by the Commonwealth Foundation. And I had to do a little digging and find out that it was paid for by the Commonwealth Foundation. They used this Harper polling group. And the question that they asked, do you believe workers who belong to a union should have the right not to have their dues money spent on political activities, which they disagree? And the number they came up with, 66% said yes. Yes. Here's the problem. Dues money isn't spent on political activity. It's already outlawed. This is a BS poll. But here's the other part of this. I listened to how ridiculous these pollings are, and I actually read through the poll that they went in, the survey that they took with 600 people, and they had a question on there that if your daughter married somebody, would you have a problem having your daughter, if you're a Steelers fan, marrying an Eagles fan? And if you're an Eagles fan, marrying a Steelers fan? And 54% of the people who were Steelers fans said that they would be okay if their daughters married an Eagles fan. And 61% who were Eagles fans said that they would be okay if their daughters married a Steelers fan. And, you know, I look at this and I go, this is just downright in-depth polling. Good, amazing stuff that we should be basing our entire economic future on, idiotic, ridiculous, stupid polls funded by the Tinky Tank over at the Tea Party think tank of the Commonwealth Foundation. But it's not surprising to me that they come up with these nonsensical polls to we'll have to do the bidding of the Koch brothers or whoever's funding them, since we're not allowed to know. Amazing stuff. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone. If you want to send me anything, rick@therickSmithShow.com. That's where you send it. Have a great one. We'll see you back. Thanks for being here.
It's coming from the wind.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the Buddha's sway.